So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
The mysterious Black Scorpion seemingly came out of nowhere, but his intentions were never a mystery.
I hope, as I intend, that you're slowly losing your mind. One thing you must remember, while everybody, including the horsemen, are chasing you, there's a big difference. Sid wants your belt. I want your life.
As the pressure continued to mount on the popular world's champion, the Black Scorpion mysteriously appeared to be everywhere Sting was.
Before you get carried away, I want you to listen to me once again. Sting. Surprised. You should be. Pay attention to your next sting.
That's a scorpion.
Yeah, fight, sting. Fight. Fight, sting.
Tonight, they meet face to face. And what will happen?
Welcome to a very special edition of Review Away. It is John Pollock, and with Wei Ting flying in the middle of nowhere, including sharing a flight on the way home from Las Vegas with one AJ Lee, we have had to bring in the artillery for today's massive review. He is the administrative editor at SureDog.com, one of the most sophisticated, brilliant men in mixed martial arts and the world at large. He is Jordan Breen, who joins us live in the beautiful Review Away studios. And Jordan, thank you so much for joining us and bringing Clash of the Champions 13 into the spotlight.
Thank you. I had to badger you a bit to get my spot here. I was offended that as a friend and as a relative work contemporary, even though I don't work in the pro wrestling field strictly, you know what's up. You could have asked me before, man.
Listen, when it comes to one of these reviews, I love having guest reviewers on, but I feel like it's quite the assignment to put on somebody to not just watch this, but then come in, do the full review. I don't like putting work upon people, and you're a very busy man. You're not the easiest person to pin down in the world, but I'm glad that we're finally going to get to do this show. And
I need catharsis in my life, though. There's times where I'm watching the network, I'm sitting there, maybe I sit down and watch something like a Clash of the Champions, and immediately after I'm done, you know, it's maybe 3 a.m. and I think Sean Pollock's not here, Wei Ting's not here, the homie Jack Encarnacio is not here, unless he's up with the newborn, rocking it gently.
Jack and Casino.
Jack in the Casino is not here. He's with the baby, being a Laps fan. I have no sounding board. I have no feelings. So there's a lot of these pro wrestling fans. I just get these pent up feelings and theories, and I need a cathartic outlet. And finally, I have it. I finally, for the first time, saw this Clash of Champions event probably, I'll say about 18 months ago. And I was flabbergasted, man. I couldn't believe how bad it fucking sucked.
You know, 18 months into, give or take, into the WWE Network era, what are your impressions of the network? What do you like about it? Do you like the fact that something as innocuous as Clash of the Champions 13 is so easily accessible, and just the overall rollout of the network, changes they've made along the way? What are Jordan Breen's impressions thus far?
I know there's obviously stuff that I can speak to. I know, like, British fans hate it because they had to wait for some other, whatever. But just speaking from my individual personal experience, independent of anything else, at this point in time, the buffer when you watch is sometimes brutal. Apparently, if you like rocking off your Xbox or something like that, it's pretty good. But for web browsers, I find it kind of sucks. It's really like, it seems to depend on the time of day and whatnot, whether or not you kind of get, you know, every 30, 45 seconds, maybe get 2 or 3 seconds of lag. That's annoying, and certainly something very recent. And as I Googled this. Apparently, people talk about if like you watch it off Xbox or a Fire Stick or something like that, it works a bit better. So maybe I'll investigate on that front. But I love it. Like, I don't watch like the breadth of stuff because, I mean, like, you know, the aughts, you know, there was a time I was out of wrestling. I didn't find it nearly as charming. I'll watch a little bit now. pretty much like pay-per-views and things of that nature. But to be able to go back and rock a whole host of things, you know, watch a Boston Garden card from the late 70s or early 80s, I love it. I think it's fantastic. And even if it's not absolutely perfect, it's about getting your flag in the direction the world's moving, man. This is where the world's headed. The world's headed to a place where someone wants to watch a pro wrestling event. You know, maybe you got something on July 4th in Japan that someone's going to pay for your service so they have the opportunity to get up at 5 a.m. and watch it. That person might just want to watch some kind of regional match from the late 70s. They might want to watch a Von Erich match from World Class in 1981. If you can provide that for them, boom, on demand, you're in the best place to provide wrestling content, I assume. That's always what the WWE wants to do.
And I guess especially for people that listen to this kind of a show, the comparison point often goes over to Fight Pass. And, I mean, you have, amongst anybody in MMA, the most encyclopedic memory.
Thank
so
you.
When it comes to a research tool, how much has Fight Pass changed just your day-to-day covering of the sport where, I mean, everything is there essentially under that Zuff umbrella?
It's scary sometimes, actually. Like, I'll do a roundtable for Sherdog and the Sherdog Radio Network, and I think, oh, I got to look at this guy's fight. My instinct is still to Google his name in, like, video and try to find some player and just realize, fuck, I don't even need to do this now. This is a waste of my time. I can just, it's actually on Fight Pass legally.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to look better. I don't have to, you know, worry about a pop-up block or any crazy ads.
Chromecast friendly.
Yeah, it's there in a heartbeat. It's absolutely fantastic. However, Fight Pass, one thing that's, you know, different. One thing I actually like about the WWE Network is looking at the edits and seeing stuff that's obviously been lopped out.
Yes.
I mean, it's not apropos of this event. And it's more appropriate if you ever get to Starrcade 90, which is the setup event for. But do you know if you watch Starrcade 90? If I say to you the Black Scorpion entrance, what do you think of?
For that particular one, we reviewed Starrcade 1990.
But did you watch it off the network?
I didn't watch it off the network, no. I would have watched probably actually a VHS copy of it that I have.
See, I don't know. I remember like the first time I saw Starrcade 90 was downloading it. So it was the actual event rip. The Black Scorpion comes out in a fucking flying cardboard UFO and lands in the ring.
See, this is not striking a particular memory
this
to me.
This is what I'm talking about. I swear to God, if you go to Google right now and type in Black Scorpion UFO, you're going to find posts from like Death Valley Driver Review Board in 1998 with people laughing at the Black Scorpion coming in a UFO, but anyone who watches it now doesn't see it because they conveniently cut that out.
Well, and the other thing was that for the Turner Home Video turnarounds, I mean, just they would take a three-hour show and edit it down into a two-hour version. Yeah. So the home videos, they would just absolutely butcher. And I don't even know if that's the case for this entrance on the home video. I very well may have just put that memory somewhere inside of my brain. But that was always my biggest complaint about those Turner releases. Was the WWF Coliseum video, you got the full event. It was always in full. And with Turner, they would always squeeze them down into 2 hours, and there would be no rhyme or reason for what they would cut out. It was just to make that 120-minute version.
Well, fortunately for you, I chose a Clash of the Champions straight off television. It was an event that was made with television in mind. It fits a tight television budget. Don't have to cut too much out. All of the garbage that was on this event.
Oh, 1990 is just...
We got to watch. And yes, I mean, there's some special stuff about this event that made me pick it over another. But even if I didn't choose Clash of the Champions, or excuse me, Clash of Champions, you notice that Ross and Paulie Dangerously, and this is not just for this event. If you watch Clash of the Champions up until, I'm going to say deep into the WCW, or like 92, 93 WCW, for whatever reason, they repeatedly refer to it as Clash of Champions, even though, A, it is clearly Clash of the Champions. B, all of the imaging, all of the graphics, everything in the arena says Clash of the Champions. How are you just leaving out the definite article?
It goes back to just last week where Rich Brennan, throughout the NXT broadcast, is plugging Beast from the East coming up on the network. I mean, come on.
Dude.
Beast in the East, and not a Scott Bigelow tribute show. But we get into this show, and I had never watched this full Clash of the Champions from start to finish. I have seen bits and pieces throughout my years. Thanksgiving Thunder, a Tuesday night Clash of the Champions card from beautiful Jacksonville, Florida.
Yeah, Thanksgiving tradition, baby. Trying to mess with Vince's schedule.
Oh, the best line was right near the end where Jim Ross said, "The next major pay-per-view in wrestling coming up, Starrcade."
Fuck the Survivor Series.
Which was
pal.
2 days later. It was, I love the subtle jabs, and Jim Ross was a master of them.
By the way,
during the early 90s.
We're talking about this moment in time, and we'll have a lot of this moment in time moments as we go throughout this. Important to note, though, in this era, seeing these individuals, Mark Calloway, Mean Mark Callis, 2 days away
from the WWF debut.
2 days away from debuting as Kane the Undertaker and being the Survivor with DiBiase.
Yes, his post Mean Mark run in WCW, it had come to an end. Now, here in 1990, you grew up in Halifax. What was kind of your viewing as a child growing up? I mean, did you get much WCW, if any? Because it was very limited, at least in Ontario, for me growing up until, you know, well into the 90s.
So I was definitely more of a, my inclination was more towards the WWE. However, we had some family friends. One of their sons was not just a nerd fanatic, pro wrestling, movies, the whole shebang, a fanatic with multiple VCRs.
So, a key at that particular time.
Yeah, so I mean, this guy is talking, I was born in 87, so I don't get to start to really kind of watch and enjoy stuff till the early 90s. Mm-hmm. But because my enjoyment was, I kind of ran this simultaneous timeline. Like, I'm growing up, I'm watching, you know, 90, 91, 92. I'm watching, you know, Gulf War, Sergeant Slaughter, and Papa Shango, and this kind of shit. But simultaneously,
amazing, like how you're shaping your early worldly views from the WWF's interpretation of a major war.
Simultaneously, though, watching and frankly preferring, even when I was young, seeing Saturday Night's Main Event and like the early WrestleManias and things of that nature. So my enjoyment of pro wrestling is kind of anachronistic in the sense that I was born in 87, but a lot of the stuff that I hold near and dear is kind of like a lot of 80s stuff. However, I didn't watch a ton of NWA, WCW stuff. So probably, I remember getting more serious about WCW simply out of convenience when my father decided to be a cable pirate. Came home with the Scrambler and Black Box. I was probably 7 or 8. And so then it was simply, oh, I mean, dude, it's Sunday night. Why not watch a pay-per-view that I'm getting for free anyway? But I wasn't privy to the NWA, WCW mutation. I wasn't privy to the ends of Jim Crockett Promotions. I had seen some stuff on tape through, you know, like family homie and stuff like that, who was just a colossal pro wrestling fan and taped everything. But I wasn't super into it till kind of later, and I did my own independent research and got to downloading things and torrenting. When I got to see this era, I think it's one of the most fascinating eras in pro wrestling, but specifically to NWA and WCW, because it is just such a product of the times, you know what I mean? Just this uneasy tension of transition. It being 1990 itself is even beautiful. You think about, like, you know, the change from the 80s to the 90s and sort of the ideas of what was cool, what was hip. Pro wrestling stands on a frontier of, do we get away from giant juiced up people? We're on pay-per-view now, television all the time. It's becoming a vastly different product. In a show like this, in this moment in time, you see everything that can go really right about pro wrestling when there's great workers and smart stuff and everything coalesces. And you see truly the drizzling shits of it all when everything goes wrong, when there's too many cooks in the kitchen, and where people who don't know the first fucking thing about pro wrestling try to guide the ship and take it straight into an iceberg of idiocy.
Yeah, this was divorced from Jim Crockett Promotions and their big...
This is the last NWA Clash of the Champions.
Yeah, this is the final Clash of the Champions under the NWA banner, and it was, you know, they had always been the meat and potatoes wrestling show in that 85 through 87 glory period with Dusty booking, and now we were several years away from that. In 1990, where it was, well, we need to capture that children's audience that the WWF has got a stranglehold on, and no conceivable form of how we're going to do that other than throw out these outlandish characters. And this was just a melting pot of all these ideas into one. And it was kind of turning off the audience that you had brought up throughout the 80s, and not really a giant plan of capturing an audience.
That's one of the things that makes this so disconcerting, too, is that, you know, you would think that a terrible pro wrestling event would be all about terrible wrestling, but there's something that makes it more of a gut punch, more of like you feel confused and disconcerted and unstable when you get, you know, a decent Brian Pillman match or a worthwhile main event with Ric Flair salvaging Butch Reed, but embedded into it you have just horrific atrocities, including what I will argue to be maybe the worst pro wrestling match I've ever seen.
Yeah, in some ways there are some parallels to TNA, where it's always been a great roster of talent that have been trying to overcome, whether it be storylines, characters, facial tattoos. I mean, these are the things that, to me, always handcuffed TNA was just tremendous talent, and it was the presentation that was just the audience was lost with.
When you see something that is in a perilous, dire state, it's all the sadder if you can see some remnant of beauty in it. You know, if you know that this could be something different or could have been something better or once was beautiful, that's why it hurts the most. And this is something that might have been beautiful once, just plunging headfirst into the abyss.
So this show, aptly entitled Thanksgiving Thunder, which predated the Thursday night and later Wednesday night.
That's what this feels like. This feels like
this
Thunder.
This was the greatest tribute to the franchise that would be unveiled some 8 years later.
I have a Thunder reference specifically for later related to the worst match in pro wrestling history. One thing right off the top, though. Can you explain to me in the open? Okay. Prior to this, Pauly Dangerously, Evil Yuppie, has the proper Motorola brick phone, the V8000 or whatever that model's called, the Zach Morris phone. Did you notice what he's holding here?
No.
It definitely looks like, and I'm sure there might be some technophile out there who's a bit older than me and be like, actually, in 1990, this would have been state of the art. It appears to me throughout the night, in the booth with Ross, Pauly Dangerously is holding a car phone with no fucking cord in it. What happened to his actual phone?
Hey, man, 1990.
It definitely has the numbers on the back and stuff like that. Is not a cell phone design I'm aware of in this time.
Maybe him and Mean Mark were sharing a car, and he got to keep the phone while Mean Mark drove up to New York.
Kane the Undertaker debuting at Survivor Series. How? Because DiBiase had the cell number.
That's it. We have Jim Ross and Pauly Dangerously calling this show, which is unique in and of itself to go back and watch these two calling a show in 1990. But right off the top, Jordan, I don't know if this was necessarily to lure people in at the top of the show, but plug 11 matches over the next 2 hours, essentially telling you...
Shout out to squash matches.
Christ, exactly. You are getting... We'll give you a main event, and then we are blitzing through 10 other matches on
huge
this particular
advantage.
Show.
Huge advantage of the Jim Ross, Pauly Dangerously booth, though. I wouldn't call him like the MVP of the show or anything like that, but in terms of individuals on the show who outperformed their usual merits, Tony Schiavone in the zone.
Tony Schiavone was, I mean, in 1990 especially, this was after he had had
Royal
his
Rumble stint,
very yeah. brief run with the WWF, and at this point in time, he came back, and he was kind of second banana here to Jim Ross on this particular show.
Yeah, he's just doing the announcing, he's getting Sting geared up on multiple occasions, getting him set up for the Black Scorpion, but it's like the Peter Principle, you know? You put Schiavone in the booth, you tell him to start hitting segues, improvising, hey, follow a script, but also improvise, but also listen to me in your headset. You know, be appropriately, you know, appropriately sell everything. Don't oversell. Don't say anything stupid. Play well with your teammates. You got two other guys in the broadcast booth. One of them might be Mongo McMichael. Don't fuck that up somehow. Please
and he's got
him.
A dog.
He's got a dog in his arms. Just giving Schiavone the dais with the, you know, you were world champion Sting. That's what Schiavone can do.
I mean, this was almost, when it comes to just broadcasters in professional wrestling, I mean, it was almost an embarrassment of riches here, where here you have Jim Ross and Pauly Dangerously calling this show. You mentioned Tony Schiavone, who, when he was in his element, a very effective talent.
Lance Russell and
Gordon Solie will be on the WCW hotline throughout the night.
They're doing an infomercial.
Christ!
They're doing an infomercial. This also goes to another thing we'll talk in passing. And it's beautiful because it dovetails with the Black Scorpion shenanigans we'll detail throughout the show. They have a couple segments on for people like hyping Starrcade. One of them is hyping Dick the Bruiser as a referee. Now, if you've seen Starrcade 9, you know that Dick the Bruiser is the referee for the main event between Black Scorpion and Sting when Ric Flair's unmasked. However, at this point in time, they clearly still have no idea what the fuck is going to happen with the Black Scorpion, no idea what's quite going to happen at Starrcade. So they have Dick the Bruiser cut this promo saying that he's refereeing, but he can't hype what he's refereeing because they literally haven't told him.
Yeah, I think that it was going to be either the tag finals or it was going to be the title match. They had not decided this yet, and this whole show was designed to set up Flair's match for Starrcade as well. I mean, it was like, that was always the knock on the Black Scorpion, was like, they kicked it off with, like, no real ending in sight, so when in doubt, we just went with Flair.
Real quick trivia note, you know the Black Scorpion has a win over someone on this card?
Who would that be?
I will unearth the trivia when we get to him or her. There's no women's on
that's
this.
That's true. It was innocuous in November of 1990. We start things off with Michael Hayes and Jimmy Garvin.
We start things off with, Paul? We start things off with Jim Cornette and Stan Lane have quit. Because this company is fucking garbage. So that is actually where we start this tale of what is supposed to be a six-man tag match featuring the Midnight Express.
And instead, we have Bobby Eaton seconding Michael Hayes and Jimmy Garvin to the ring, not for a six-man tag. Bobby Eaton was the lone member of the Midnight Express that would stick around after.
Always stuck around. Heart of gold, Bobby Eaton.
Bobby Eaton, an incredible man, along with Little Richard Marley. As they would take on, how about this, appropriate given the current political controversy.
I thought of this too, so many Confederate fucking flags.
The Southern Boys, Tracy Smothers and Steve Armstrong. And Tracy Smothers, I mean, it could be debatable what fashion statement was louder, the Confederate flag or the Zubaz later on with fanny pack. I mean, this guy, pro wrestling stereotype fashion on this particular event.
They're both of the Southern Boys are wearing Zubaz, white and creamsicle orange, or actually white and blood orange. Orange with fanny packs, actually, later on when they reveal El Gigante, who at this point, we're told by the terrible Dancing Freebirds. Michael, this is another thing that bothers me. I get that, like, rock and roll gimmicks were big in the 80s, and there's something charming about when you see, like, rock and roll Buck Zumhoff, and you see how ridiculous, like, you know that guy wasn't a rock star. Never mind being a pedophile.
You mean with the Ghetto Blaster?
Yeah.
That wasn't enough cred for you?
No. But there's something almost charming about that. I hate when dudes try to go, like hard glam. Like, dude, Michael Hayes and Jimmy Garvin are two of the worst dancers I've seen, like, even just in pro wrestling.
Shawn Michaels never got enough hatred for, like, an atrocious dancer that I thought worked for the gimmick.
Absolutely.
Dissolution.
Shawn Michaels.
Heartbreak Kid.
The Heartbreak Kid dancing, even him doing his own vocals, you know what that's like? That's like real dick sports stars and bros when they get drunk and do karaoke. Like, if you're a football fan, like, that's when Rob Gronkowski is tanked at a bar somewhere in New England and grabs the mic
and requests
tries to rap.
Journey.
Yeah, or something like that, you know. Shawn Michaels' dance moves are so fucking cheese and so stupid, but they're cheese and stupid in the way that if you saw a dude do that, you'd be like, this asshole. And it's feasible that some girl with some serious issues in her life would be like, he's hot.
And taking that same theme song and to this day was able to transfer that into, like, this legendary, iconic character with that theme song.
Yeah.
Incredible.
And multiple iterations. It worked when it was Sherry. It worked when it was Sean.
I love the Sherry version.
I love Sherry. R.I.P. My girl.
That angle where they go for the mirror and take out Sherry. I mean, they had some fantastic stuff in the early 90s.
Dude, Sherry was for the boys. Sherry was down for the game. Sensational Sherry. She's queen of pro wrestling to me. She's no, you know, she's not Bull Nakano or anything like that, but Sherry rules.
The money that Marty Jannetty left on the table in his career, astronomical.
I think he snorted up most of the money off the table.
That's a fair assessment for a guy that is just, you know, he was on our show years ago, and it was the most sad answer when he talked about every single day he wakes up with regret and goes to sleep with regret of what he missed out on and what he cost himself.
And a guy that orbited close to it, you know what I mean? We'll talk about, like, Buddy Landell in a second, who just passed away.
Yeah, that's very, comparison.
That's a guy who had some talent but seemed further away from it, you know what I mean? He had those, like, Jannetty was there. Jannetty always got work, just could not get his shit together long enough to. Speaking of guys who couldn't get over it, the Southern Boys here, taking great spots. Dude, Armstrong does a dive, just jumps right over the rope onto the ramp with a crossbody on Garvin. Boys are working out here.
Jim Ross had a great line in here. Said, Richard Marley isn't here for moral support because he doesn't have any. Great Rossism. Armstrong came off the top, as he said, with a high cross. These two could do no wrong in front of this crowd.
Nope.
Who were just insane for the Southern boys.
Also, they could work.
Oh, absolutely they could.
One thing that's also good about this, and you don't see it, like, I like tag team wrestling. I mentioned being an 80s dude. Tag team wrestling gets shit on all over. I guess there's kind of like a quasi-indie renaissance now. You know what I mean? But it's different. You know, I think the Young Bucks are dope. But you watch tag team matches now, and it's like, oh, all right, we're about 10, 12 minutes. We've stopped tagging. It's time for some ring clear-outs and just full-out bedlam.
Mm-hmm.
Until there's, you know, some kind of counter to a counter to a counter to a finish, and it's over. Tag team wrestling in this era, like, it takes a special kind of skill. Their timing here and just way of working simple tag team wrestling, nice stuff. Like, it's a prototype NWA match.
A lot of that, what they would take from the Andersons, just cut off the ring, isolate, build to the hot tag. I mean, there was some phenomenal tag team wrestling throughout this entire era of NWA, WCW. What did you interpret from this line, which I believe was made from Dangerously? And like true Southerners, the Southern boys do nothing but double team. Just leave that one hanging.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Dangerously with a lot of geopolitical stuff. He mentions on multiple occasions, he marks out for Mike Rotunda earlier, shouting out to Syracuse, New York, Scarsdale.
And then
area.
Later, yeah, the Scarsdale chapter they would bring out. They got the heat on Tracy Smothers, stops Garvin on the top, tosses him off. They make the hot tag to Armstrong, but the referee doesn't see it, or as Vince McMahon would decree, his vision was impaired, if you saw the leaked document last week. Armstrong then back body drops Garvin over the top to the ramp, one of about 10 infractions of the over-the-top rule just being bastardized on this particular show.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I was watching this, especially watching the main event. I guess Flair throws Reed through the ropes a couple times, but there's there's cross bodies over the ropes. Pillman does air Pillman over the ropes on the ramp.
And the announcers
ramp.
Bring up the rule, like, every time.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, that's illegal. That's illegal. Baby faces, heels, they all were.
Yeah, so there was a couple times and I was like, is this still? And then Ross and Asian would be like, that's illegal. And I think, all right, well, fuck it. All right, cool, wrestling, we're going.
So it ends with a dive over the top onto Garvin, and then the referee is distracted as Michael Hayes hits his DDT after Marley is on the floor and trips up Smothers, leading to the DDT, and Michael Hayes gets the fall. 4 minutes and 50 seconds, or as you could say on this Clash of Champions card, just about Broadway.
Yeah. I mean,
450. I mean, that was pushing things on this show.
Well, also Broadway, because 450 is a tremendous length of time for this show, but also this is a tremendous work rate and general success for this show.
This was like right up there in terms of the standout positives of this show.
This is a boilerplate 5-minute NWA tag match. And I mean, it's got too many people in it for reasons we explained and whatnot. Just terrible booking. But they work a standard match and then they go above and beyond. They get some over the top rope spots. Southern boys are diving everywhere. Even though it's a bullshitty heel finish, it's at least clean and not overly convoluted. This is an above average pro wrestling match, and that's a doozy of a compliment for this particular card.
Yeah, and always sets the stage when you have a hot crowd in the opener and you would just watch it descend throughout this particular show, which happened in Jacksonville.
Don't worry, Sting's about to get him picked up. Sting's out here in his WCW satin back jacket.
Oh boy, the fashion at this time, man, the merch that these guys must have been flying off the
Did you notice, by the way, this is not the only cool attire that Sting wears tonight? Sting makes a costume switch in between segments.
Oh, that is true. And it's noted. Shivani is on the podium and brings out Sting in his WCW jacket and then starts rapping and plugs that he will be on the Danger Zone tonight with Pauly Dangerously. And then the entire Veterans Memorial Coliseum is engulfed by the voice of the Black Scorpion.
All right, the Stinger, prepare for later on right here on national TV. And fans will have more on TBS right after that. Don't you dare go away.
Sting.
What in the world?
Wait a second.
Sting.
If you know something about this, you better let me know what's going on.
Apparently
the people have waited for you, but I know you have been waiting for me.
Apparently the voice of the Black Scorpion, Jim Paul, I know everybody can hear it, the Stinger once again.
I'll tell you what, Sting, in just a short while, I'll give you and everyone a chance to see my great powers of black magic in just a little while, Sting.
They try to go to commercial first, which is actually, they actually do it in a really moronic way, I think. Because when I was watching this, I was imagining, like, I'm watching TBS, I'm watching the Superstation, it's 1990. And, you know, Shimani's like, wrestling fans, we'll be right back. And they show, like, the Chiron, you know, we'll be right back. And they start to switch. I'm assuming the people in 1990 still had relatively similar television habits. Isn't that the moment where you switch? You know they're about to go to a commercial. Aren't you changing?
Whatever
they
else was on Tuesday night. Maybe,
they don't.
go check up on Evening Shade,
yeah,
like, or whatever.
Yeah,
on.
Is Roseanne got a new episode on? You know what I mean? They switch to the Black Scorpion voice in the arena almost too late. Like, I feel like there's a decent amount of people who would have been like, click, and then would have completely missed this. Nonetheless, Ole Anderson's voice starts booming after Sting. Sting's kind of in party bro mode. Sting, a guy who basically gets the rap, is a guy who had a lot of talent, but just wasn't that dynamite in a promo. 10 seconds of just Sting acting weird, I'm down. He was good.
Did you ever peruse one Ole Anderson when he wrote his book? Did you ever read any of this?
No, I can't imagine.
I'm only reading it now for the first time, and it's.
I watched a video, and we'll mention it when we get to the Z-Man. I watched a shoot interview with Ole Anderson. I know what Ole's reputation is. Like, I'm not an idiot. The interviewer asks him, you know, basically whether or not he felt like he lost part of the locker room when he had Vader squash Tom Zank.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you talk to, you know, and listen to other interviews and stuff, the overwhelming consensus among, like, guys like Zank and Pillman and guys that were smaller workers trying to come up, guys that weren't like Brian Clark, who gets a push for the evening to the detriment of the history of pro wrestling on this card. Guys like that felt alienated because Vader came in with the steaming Mastodon head and just took a giant cold diarrhea dump all over Tom Zank. Ole, dude, and the reason you know he's bullshitting is one of the classic obfuscation tactics is, you know, to answer questions with questions, to feign ignorance. And Ole acts like he doesn't even know what the question is. The guy basically asks him point blank, like, you know, do you think it was hard? You know, do you think you lost some of the locker room when you had Vader squash Tom Zank? And he basically asks, like, you know, he might as well have said, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, I never had. He basically stops one step short of denying that Vader wrestled Zank or that he had Vader beat Zank. And for 5 minutes, he browbeats this guy until the guy basically has to alter his question to, well, all right, so you don't really recall any backlash. And Ole's like, no. And you just think, well, then why did 24 people others say different?
Yeah.
Like, what?
With Ole, it was, you know, he would.
I'm not saying it's wrong. Vader's the best monster heel ever, but.
Oh, but he came in and he was the project. He was the guy that, I mean, Inoki had this incredible character for, and they were going to transfer that over.
Had this incredible character for the Ultimate Warrior.
And I mean, that has been a consistent theme throughout wrestling is like, you know, the guy that comes in that you guys are going to make this monster. But with Ole, it would always be fascinating that this guy would just incite these battles with people. I mean, him and Dave Meltzer had this legendary show.
Oh, I've heard.
It was an hour of Ole essentially coming to this conclusion that Dave Meltzer is keeping him out of the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, which if you have ever followed, this is an election process. It is as if you are getting upset at a voter for not being elected mayor of your city.
It's also insane too, because Dave Meltzer, I think we can both say safely, we love Big Dave.
Absolutely.
Like the godfather of this shit. A man who, I mean, I cover MMA for a living. You know, that's what I do. Big Dave's the OG. Who knows if I'm here without him? So shouts to Big Dave. But he is not the kind of guy that you want as like the sympathetic explainer. You know what I mean? The guy who's going to be like, actually, look, let me explain this to you real quick. Like, he is not that guy, especially with someone who's like in the business and emotional. Him trying to explain his thought process to Ole and explain to Ole why he's crazy without straight up telling him off.
Yeah.
It was literally like just watching two people head each other, or like listening to two people headbutt each other for an insane period of time.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a fascinating discussion because it's just point counterpoint. And it's just Ole's anger versus Dave's facts. And I think you can anticipate what the outcome was. Yeah. By your, the end of the hour, you have a clear opinion.
Ascending Oli rage, but also Dave's kind of ascending rage in like the idea that he can't understand that an objective argument about like facts and the territories and who is over and who booked this isn't going to change this delusional bitter man's mind.
It's an amazing fascination that it's, you know, Oli represented that in that interview, and you don't get it as much today as you did with another generation, but this idea of the media that covers professional wrestling, the old, oh, you've never taken a bump, and almost this disposition that if you have never done this, then we do this form of entertainment that is beneath coverage. Why would you possibly be covering this? And it's almost this distaste that there is a media that covers you. And yeah, it permeates to mixed martial arts as well, but there's still a mindset in professional wrestling where it's like the idea of our industry being covered is just, I cannot fathom that.
Yeah, who wants to know about what you do, where you do it, why, for how much? Who gives a shit? No one wants to know about you, apparently.
Our next matchup is, yes, the late Buddy Landell and Flyin' Brian. Drop the G. Flyin' Brian. Landell, the heel, introduced from Jacksonville, Florida, and still booed.
I was gonna say, I hope you point out the fact that they announced him from Jacksonville, and he's still booed because everyone in the crowd is like, who is this fatter version of Flair with the no pecs?
I mean, this, by the time of 1990, I mean, Landell's kind of brush with any kind of superstardom, I mean, that was kind of in the rear view. He would still have the run in Smoky Mountain Wrestling.
Which got him the WWF run for 2 seconds.
Which got him, yeah, the one pay-per-view match with Ahmed Johnson and then some TV squashes.
So can we both say, especially at this point in his career, Buddy Landell just looks like comedian Richard Lewis with platinum blonde hair?
Oh, my God. It is a scary comparison to one Richard Lewis. Buddy Landell, Buddy Landell was somebody that, I mean, I watched enough of to know that this guy really could have been something, especially with his promo ability.
Good promo.
But
very
man,
good promo.
He's one of those guys that you just look back at, and I mean, just a classic character in from 1980s professional wrestling. Yeah. I mean, a guy that dropped out of high school to go into professional wrestling. Not much more need to be said. Fantastic athlete, great promo, and just his own worst enemy.
Yeah, and also you can tell that it's actually kind of evident in him being that sort of guy, because he takes a bump here that, you know, a lot of workers wouldn't want to do. Pillman does a springboard crossbody from the ropes to the floor, and obviously back then, the arenas aren't set up to do shit like this. So the guardrail is so close, it's like some kind of like indie show now. Pillman crushes him, and he goes back first into the guardrail, and it looks painful as fuck.
Heyman, of course, bringing up the over-the-top rule here. Once again, just have your shots ready at home for these references. Landell takes that back body drop on the ramp, as Jordan mentioned, and then drops him throat first on the barricade. Both take turns, sending each other into the post. There's a reverse cross off the second rope to the floor and into the barricade, and then Landell regains the advantage. He's working over the lower back. Pillman blocks a superplex and hits a high cross for the win. 5 minutes and 50 seconds for this one, with Heyman referring to Pillman as wrestling's version of Pete Rose for being a cheat, and double points for the Cincinnati Connection.
And also tries to hype him up as the only man that Ric Flair has ever trained, a thing that we forget that's been completely abandoned.
Yes, it didn't really become part of Brian Pillman's pedigree.
No, not in the slightest. Also, interesting little bit in the finish, and I'll mention this later, we get a kind of finish that you don't get anymore. I don't mean the cross body. I mean the finish where the dude who takes the fall is finished clean, little bit of kickiness, but does that kick out a half second after. Basically,
that was a trademark for a lot of guys at this point.
But it's also just very common in this era.
Yeah.
I almost feel like somehow the end of it, and to be fair, you see it, it's more of a territories thing, it seems like. In Vince's product, you see it way less, apart from guys like Hogan trying to take Warrior's heat at WrestleMania
right.
6.
Yes. Yeah, it was always the trick of the guy doing the job that you always...
Yeah, like Shawn Michaels' dick tactic
Slaughter,
to ruin the friends.
Slaughter did it at Mania 7 with Hogan. I mean, it took some balls to do it with Hogan, but nonetheless, it was always, you know, the little trick to kind of keep some of your heat afterwards.
Slaughter's a rebel, dude. He got the one rebel LGN action figure, you know?
He had to do it for a rock. Starcade 1990 promo, some... tremendous 1990 production here with an echo effect.
Oh, yeah.
Boy, and a promising an explosive night that will rock the universe. I don't know if Rock meant a subtle tribute to Ole Anderson there.
Well, I do know that we're about to get an explosion and everything's about to crumble because, ladies and gentlemen, the big cat Curtis Hughes is on the way to the ring.
Curtis Hughes, folks.
Curtis Hughes' entrance is literally, especially because Curtis Hughes enters before Brad Armstrong. So definitively, Curtis Hughes' entrance is when this night just takes a fucking dive.
Curtis Hughes, I mean, at the end of the day, many wrestlers will look back at the money they drew and what they made from professional wrestling. If there is a statement that Curtis Hughes can make about his wrestling career in terms of dollars and cents, it would be headlined by the letters IOU.
Because absolutely.
Wrestling gave Curtis Hughes way more than Curtis Hughes gave professional wrestling. And this was one of many, many runs that this man got throughout the 90s. First of all, comes out and cuts his pre-match promo wearing his zebra top.
He's wearing a deep V-neck zebra poncho.
Cuts a promo on Lex Luger, who will be the main course, and threatens to eat him later tonight.
Okay, this is also something I'm saying. We'll get to this with Luger. Luger's working a program, not even just a program. Luger's working arguably the best program of his career with Stan Hansen, being the longest reigning U.S. champion ever. Why are we trying to shoehorn this weird Curtis Hughes thing? Also, you know, I don't have too much to say bad about this match. Because in honesty, Curtis Hughes is very limited, but Brad Armstrong makes him look very good here.
Armstrongs are 2 for 2 on this show.
Brad Armstrong, I give him 10 out of 10 Bret Harts for this one. He sells the shit out of all Hughes' offense without overselling like Shawn Michaels and making it look like, you know, a mockery and making him look like a dick.
You should clarify, the Candyman.
The Candyman's got on a satin back jacket.
Brad Armstrong's dropkick, I mean, one of the better ones in history.
What are your top three? Who are your favorite dropkicks? Leaving out, like, presently, Kazuchika Okada.
Okada would be in that discussion. I would say Jim Brunzel. Jim Brunzel would be in mine. I thought Bob Holly had a tremendous
very
one.
Good.
I thought Lance Storm. I have seen stills of Lance Storm, and the height that he got was utterly incredible. Those would be ones that come to mind. Yourself?
Lance Storm, Jim Brunzel, Kurt Hennig.
Kurt Hennig got a very
Kurt
nice
Hennig,
drop kick. Because he would do like almost like this little like
kick
squat
back.
In
yeah.
the, and then
that's,
boom, just
that's
out.
The thing, man. A Storm got the height, you know what I mean? And like you get those stills where it just like it looks breathtaking. But Hennig did a drop kick that somehow...
It looked like you were knocking the wind out of the guy
yeah,
when he would
it
execute
added, it. It added that level of kayfabe drama where it almost felt like it felt easier to suspend disbelief that someone got fucked up from this guy kicking them like that.
Sometimes like would grab the hair
yeah,
as
absolutely.
He'd elevate. There was a high drop kick from Armstrong early on, and then it's caught by Big Cat, who then hits him with 3 backbreakers.
The Big Cat, Ernie Ladd.
And,
seriously, why is Curtis... Dude, is it just like he's a football player? He got it because he was a legit football player at Kansas State.
Yep.
You know, just a guy who didn't catch on, you know, not unlike a Luger himself, although Luger made it to the USFL. Did promos just look at him like, yeah, you're going to have Ernie Ladd's gimmick? Ernie Ladd's not wrestling anymore. You can just have Ernie Ladd's gimmick.
That was essentially it, minus the promo ability.
Minus the promo.
The talent.
Minus the promo, minus the afro. Minus the two best parts of Ernie Ladd, really.
Paulie dangerously notes.
Oh, please tell me. If this is the exact quote I have written down, I have like one quote written down from the show.
It's definitely 100% the same one I have.
There you go. The man that has been using Lex Luger's finishing maneuver, the Big Cat, and this guy does not pussyfoot around.
Okay, no, it's not,
oh,
but
wow.
But this gets worse later when, because this is the best part of Curtis Hughes' night. Curtis Hughes shows up later to help author the most putrescent piece of this entire piece of shit, but, in this particular moment, Paulie Dangerously, bad pun, he does it worse later because he yells, I think I taw a putty tat twice at the top of his lungs.
Yeah, that was bad.
This is the line that I mentioned because Paulie Dangerously says, and this has to be a secret shoot. The Big Cat shows you how far a football player in world championship wrestling can go. Oh, you don't say.
That's a great little hidden gem in this particular match and summarizes it pretty damn well. Armstrong comes back with drop kicks. A second one misses, and he hurts his back. Cat applies a torture rack.
A theme for the evening. Guys stealing other people's finishers. Huge theme. Clearly, this is something that Ole Anderson loved, because this happens at least three times on this card.
It went 4.5 minutes, meaning it was 20 seconds shorter than the Southern Boys match. And Jim Ross and Paulie Dangerously into this catty back and forth as Ross is trying to protect Brad Armstrong.
Why do you need to keep Brad Armstrong strong? He's a jobber. This is what he does. His skill as a wrestler. And dude, it's not a glamorous one, but for people like you and me, if we have to hand out hardware at the end of this, you know, give gold medals, that, you know, the Armstrongs are going to be in this. Because they came to this show just a cesspool of idiocy for the most part, and they balled out. Brian Armstrong made a zero look like 7.5, 8, like a guy with some real skill who could move. So, you know, really, really covered him up well. And he jobs. This is what he does. He is the definition of an enhancement talent. Emphasis on the enhancement and the talent. Good at both. Jim Ross is furious that Paulie Dangerously suggests he has given up to the torch rack.
Ross will not allow. And this is not just a simple point counter.
No.
It was like three back and forth.
Thank you. It's three back and forth. Dangerously starts it and says that he gave up. Ross instantly becomes indignant and screams that he didn't give up. And referee, I think it's Randy Anderson, stopped it. Dangerously, no. He gave up, Ross. Ross is apoplectic. Then Dangerously says he gave up again to set up the replay, after which point Ross screams him down again before segueing. I guess we got to keep Brad Armstrong hot. He's the candy man.
I think...
got to keep him strong.
Brad Armstrong, the candy man. Dick the Bruiser promo, as we mentioned earlier, announces he is coming to Starrcade.
I'm Dick the Bruiser. I'm the toughest guy ever. I'm going to ref a match. I don't know what it is. Fuck Cole Anderson.
Then we were in for another treat, because the treats just kept coming.
Is this, to your knowledge, kind of the first, like, I don't want to use the primetime joke, but is this kind of like the mainstream primetime debut for primetime Brian Lee?
This has to be the earliest I watched Brian Lee.
I don't think of Brian Lee necessarily as a bad worker. He sucks in this. He is quite bad.
He has, in an era where the mullets were aplenty.
Outstanding mullet, though.
Like, this guy was just something else. And, I mean, the Z-Man to boot, I mean, was had his own style here.
This is interesting, like, an interesting point on style, though. By the way, I Judas myself. I got so into it. Since we were talking about the Black Scorpion thing, well, we're talking about guys that maybe Ole Anderson didn't like the worst. The guy that the Black Scorpion beat at a house show, I believe, Brian Pillman.
No kidding.
Yeah, well, seriously. Yeah.
Did Brian Pillman give up, or did he pass out?
because
if Jim Ross is calling that match, you're damn sure he's protecting Pillman in this one.
So the reason I bring this up is, you know, Pillman, Z-Man, guys that get lumped in as, you know, higher flyer guys, you know, baby faces, didn't quite get over, they didn't quite fit into a certain... Okay, Brian Lee, if you think about Brian Lee in your head, you think, like, you know, under faker, he's a big biker, like, you think a big dude. Dude, he is like the same size as Zenk and in markedly worse shape.
Yeah,
Zenk is like an inch or two shorter than him and cut up like with a six pack. Like the idea that like some of these guys were like these, you know, the idea that Tom Zenk was like this tiny fly of a junior heavyweight that should have been squashed pathetically by Vader versus like Brian Lee, like disciple of the apocalypse. Dude, Tom Zenk is barely smaller than him and in much better shape.
Looks-wise, just a poor man's Dan Spivey, essentially, Brian Lee.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Dude, he's a softer-looking version of Dan Spivey, too. I was actually laughing in my head. Dan Spivey, even when he had the bleach blonde receding, like, he still kind of looked like an evil, wild dude. And when you see him in the skyscrapers and stuff like that, like, he looks like someone's alcoholic stepdad off the chain. Brian Lee looks soft.
Yeah, I mean, this guy was not some menacing look where it was just like you saw dollar
signs. He looks like a bigger Ricky Morton.
He does. That minus every ounce of talent.
Minus charisma and talent.
Yeah. But Lee, this match, like, just fell apart. Lee,
there's one moment where it falls apart. I'll let you detail it.
Lee takes this huge bump off of a hip toss, like the kind of the overcompensating sell to try.
It's a Henning Flair bump, but it's worse because it's Tom Zenk and Lee. Lee also just jumps. You know how like Flair and Henning jump deep
so it looks like they're going far. He jumps high like he's trying to dunk a basketball because he's an idiot.
So Zenk decides to follow up by hopping to the top for a reverse crossbody.
Like, and keep in mind, like, Lee oversells this. The idea in Zenk's head, I don't know if they're calling the match in close here. The idea is clearly that Lee is supposed to turn around and walk into this crossbody, even though, keep in mind, he ends up all the way at the far diagonal turnbuckle, while Tom Zenk runs no look to the far turnbuckle, literally the furthest points of the ring.
So Zenk ends up going for this reverse cross and hits nothing. Brian Lee is not there.
He hits the middle of the ring while Brian Lee is still at the far turnbuckle.
These two had the timing of the Brian Kendrick, Eva Marie training segment on Total Divas last week. I mean, that is a great comparison point. Zenk then lands a drop kick, and Ross then brings up that this pay-per-view is available for free for all the U.S. soldiers for Operation Desert Storm, and WCW will be sending them a banner.
Well, great.
A clash.
Speaking of WCW visuals, I had to be tripping on this. There's no way this could have been like this screwed up. It had to be like a camera angle thing. I was convinced watching this that the WCW letters at the top of the ramp were crooked.
It didn't stand out to me. Totally possible. When they had like the kind of the prom entrance era,
yeah,
where it just everything had like, yeah, the
letters didn't
the
look
total
space,
prom look.
The letters didn't look spaced properly, and it looked like the far W was up higher than the first one, so it almost like slanted up, but not like in a natural fashion. Anyway, Brian Lee's in here having a terrible pro wrestling match.
But then Zenk drop kicks him off the top and goes for the cover, and Brian Lee kicks out at two. They count three, and the match ends in 3 minutes and 10 seconds. My description at the end was total clusterfuck.
That late kickout pin, trying to do the Buddy Landell. Buddy Landell's a veteran, pal.
Brian Lee was not.
Brian Lee, you don't think.
I can't imagine what their post-match chat was in the back, but I imagine Tom Zenk livid after this.
We're talking about chats that we can't imagine. Imagine this chat. You're Mike Rotundo.
We got this great idea, dude.
Or you're Mike Rotundo, whatever your name is. You're a respected worker. You've already been a WWF Tag Team Champion. You've actually been a legit amateur wrestler at Syracuse.
Yep.
You know, shit popped off in the locker room. You could immobilize one of these larger roid heads and probably beat their ass. You've done the Varsity Club. Great, respectable stable. You're not long removed from that. Varsity Club goes by the wayside. Ken Sullivan's out of here. We need to form the Miracle Violence Connection in All Japan because that's a better use of Steve Williams than this shit. So, Mike Rotundo, we got to do something different for you. Do you have any, like, shoot info on this? Is this like a Bradshaw thing? Did he make a couple dope investments and boys in the locker room found out and someone thought this would be funny? Why, with this moment, do we start, Mike Rotunda's into money. He's into stocks. He's into taxes. He likes short sleeves with a tie and suspenders. What is this shit, and why does it start here with Michael Wall Street?
I don't know which WCW executive saw the movie Wall Street, but man, did they fall in love with that movie.
So they saw Michael Douglas and just thought Rotunda's the guy because he's got the right kind of mullet.
Well, this has always been something that, I mean, it's happened.
Obviously, DiBiase helps.
It helps, but, I mean, this character would essentially be the blueprint for
all of
the rest of his career.
This is what I'm talking about. Also, I left out the part where they made him a boat captain.
That's right.
R.I.P. Captain Mike.
Yeah, that ship sank.
but this is what's important. This is what I marked down here. Not only, like, this gimmick on the face isn't dumb, especially his part. The dumb part of this is the York Foundation part and the laptop computer and the printouts, which we'll talk about. Terry Runnels is breathtaking here, by the way, looking every bit the bodacious 1990s babe you'd hope.
Absolutely. Looking fantastic here in 1990.
Hair volume on 11. Big, and oversized plastic colored glasses. Looks great. Love her.
So whenever you want to make a rapid character change, there's usually a few tropes that you'll find in professional wrestling. A legal changing of the name.
Always.
And, of course, inherited money.
Always.
Which Michael Wall Street has just magically fallen into. So his name is now Michael Wall Street. That is his legal name.
I find it interesting that he inherits his money and shares none of it with his family.
No.
Like Barry Windham doesn't start driving a better car and get a new gimmick.
No wonder Bray's pissed and has father issues. So we are going to learn the entire Michael Wall Street story this 6:05 Saturday night.
6:05 p.m. Eastern. WCW Saturday night, TBS Superstation. Be there for your Michael Wall Street unveiling.
Jordan,
promo.
There's never been a time I have more wanted episodes of Saturday night to be on the network than this moment and to watch the Michael Wall Street story.
There's a couple times where I'm just sitting around in the abyss and darkness of my life and think, did Ice Train win any matches on TV in 1998?
Fire and ice, baby.
How else am I going to find out? I'm not going to find out on Nitro.
So he introduces York, and she has a computer printout with the...
She also has a computer.
She has a computer.
she has the Commodore 64 paper, but she is also carrying a laptop computer,
yeah.
Which, kudos to her. You know, Heyman's, you know, not to sound like a dick, Heyman's a man. He's carrying around a brick phone. She's a tiny, beautiful woman carrying around a monstrosity of a portable computer.
She needed to have a floppy disk, though, with each with Star Blazer written on top of the floppy. And she's made this...
Star Blazer, Tim Horner, by the way, doing Tim Horner things. If it's not Tim Horner, or who's the guy who played Jack Victory? Let's call him Jack Victory. You're watching Clash of the Champions, expect to see a Jack Victory, but we got no Jack Victory here. Tim Horner always finds a way to get on these sorts of events.
Yes.
Better believe you'll see some Tim Horner if there's no Jack Victory available.
So the gimmick, for those of you that are not familiar, was that Alexandra York has this computer program that will solve every opponent, that if Michael Wall Street follows this move by move by move, he'll win every time. He can't... This computer program, it's the game genie of professional wrestling. You can't lose.
Alexandra York is hacks.
So how do we get this gimmick across in its first match against Star Blazer?
A.K.A. the yellow-blue blazer, played by Tim Horner.
Yes. Now, my first reaction was this idea of a printout, move by move. Was this a rib on Randy Savage?
Oh, that's a clever idea. That might be a thing. Especially, too, because it's not even just a move-by-move printout. Like, when you watch the matches, and this continues on when they add Thomas Rich and whoever the fuck else they add to this York Foundation.
Earl Robert Eaton would be one later down, in terms of names, yeah, where they would go that direction.
Rotunda wouldn't, like, read the printout thoughtfully in the corner, like, sit on the corner apron for a second, read it, and then crumple it up and throw it away like Inspector Gadget or whatever. They would, like, confer back and forth, which is obviously more akin to Randy Savage, like, sitting down and planning his match spot for spot for spot for spot with everyone that he ever worked with.
And, of course, this was also, you know, just removed from Ricky Steamboat returning to WCW.
Yeah.
And everyone always had the comparison of, oh, Ricky Steamboat's match with Savage and the classics with Flair. And Steamboat always said that, you know, the difference was, for the Savage match, we knew everything from start to finish, whereas me and Flair went out there and just did the match. Mm-hmm. So here we are, and I always considered this to just be a subtle knock on Randy Savage and his preparation. Now, the Michael Wall Street gimmick, someone who enjoyed it was Jim Ross, because of the lines he got to bring out in this particular match. Wall Street takes a series of drop kicks, and Ross notes that Wall Street may be crashing. Mm. Then he makes a comeback called the Hostile Takeover, and then an abdominal stretch is applied by Wall Street.
You better believe he cheats.
His stock almost dropped as Blazer fights back, and then a Boston Crab is countered by Blazer. Wall Street applies a Boston Crab off his back, which gets broken, and then he hits the Wall Street Crash for the win at 4-14. Now, if I'm going to be putting together this gimmick that this guy cannot be beaten by anybody, there should have been no selling from Wall Street in this entire match. It should have been just a systematic breakdown of Star Blazer.
You know what's double ridiculous about this? Rotunda could have actually done this, because a good way to do a match like that where someone looks inert and helpless is do the Roddy Piper shoot spot. Have Rotunda actually go in and wrestle this dick like an amateur wrestling match and stretch him while beating him up.
And just shut him completely down.
You know what I mean? And, like, at that point in time, too, it's easy to do because you just have to tell Tim Horner, you know, like, Tim Horner might get hit a drop kick or something like that. But basically, he just has to struggle at three-quarters capacity while Rotunda styles on him and hits go-behinds and lifts and throws him all over the place.
So is the computer program, is it able to identify what the opponent is going to be able to do? This was not a stunning run for one Mike Rotunda.
It was not a good rollout. No, it was not.
And would really be just a series of bad gimmicks for this guy.
By the way, speaking on Rotunda, for a guy that, honestly, I think it's weird. For a guy that he's an amateur wrestler, like that's what he did. Think about other amateur wrestlers and the problems they have getting into pro wrestling. One, I think Rotunda's literally a better promo than he was in the ring. Two, how is it that Rotunda has terrible wrestling moves for a guy who's an actual wrestler?
He has
a shitty Samoan drop. His Boston Crab in this looks bad. He applies terrible-looking rest holds and always did. Dude, his IRS run in the WWF is so phoned in. He's responsible for one of the worst pins I've ever seen when he pins Fred Typhoon Ottman at, I think, a SummerSlam or something like that. It's the worst roll-up I've ever seen in the history of pro wrestling. For a dude who could actually do this, Rotunda was bad at all the parts you'd think he'd be good at and surprisingly good at the parts you'd think he'd be shit at. What gives?
In fairness, the man wrestled in suspenders.
And dress shoes.
And dress shoes. And slacks.
Dude.
You gotta cut him some.
Man.
But how about this? The fact that this guy, whether it was the WWF runs, WCW, All Japan, had a very healthy run there when All Japan was just kind of existing. This guy's gainfully been employed.
Well, it's got to be because he's smart. Because when I see this dude, I don't think you're an awesome, gifted wrestler. Because if you were, you would have been Shelton Benjamin.
Yeah, was not Shelton Benjamin in any sense.
You know, he was smart enough to get a pro. Dude, he got IRS over. Say what you want, IRS was over as shit. He came out to a fucking typewriter sound. He got this over. You know, clearly Rotunda had a kind of a more of a brain. And isn't he a road agent now?
Yeah.
So he's clearly got a brain for the business, and that's why he stuck around. It ain't because he was good in the ring.
Yeah, I mean, a guy that, listen, this is not a bad a blueprint of managing your career. Probably saved a lot of his money. I mean, shoot gimmick. Then we had Gordon Soley, who plugs WCW Magazine and then takes us through the top 10. I wonder if members of the media were asked to contribute
to
these.
I see you actually wrote the top 10.
Oh, I've got them. I want your genuine reaction to these from 10 to 1 here.
Okay, can we just skip to the part where it's Norman the Lunatic and whoever he's teamed up with?
Norman and the Juicer?
Right! Oh, Art Barr, rest in fucking peace. Dude, Art Barr. You know, dude, he's not on here for Los Gringos Locos.
No, he's here with Norman the Lunatic.
Christ.
Big Cat and the Motor City Madmen.
The Motor City Madmen, who we're going to see momentarily.
Christ, unfortunately. Tim Horner and the Candyman. The Master Blasters, Kevin Nash and Al Green. The Southern Boys, Morton and Rich. The Freebirds, the Nasty Boys, who were just a few months away from winning the tag titles at WrestleMania. Ric Flair and Arn, and then the Steiner Brothers, and then our champions at the time, Doom. And then our singles rankings, Beautiful Bobby jumping up into the number 10 spot. That was his negotiation. Please stay, we'll put you in the top 10. The Z-Man, Michael Wall Street, Brian Pillman, Terry Taylor, who was nowhere on this show, Arn, Flair, Luger, Vicious, and Stan Hansen, with our champion being Sting. And then they plugged the main event of Sting and the Black Scorpion for Starrcade 1990.
Don't do it, guys.
A month out from their biggest show of the year, and they don't know who's playing half of the main event yet.
Maybe they thought it was actually going to be the real magician dude. Hazari, whatever the hell his name is.
They had a video on the Pat O'Connor Memorial International Tag Team Tournament.
Okay, we got to talk about this real quick. So yep. the Pat O'Connor Memorial Tournament is born of two things. One, this is, you know, the continuing legacy of Jim Crockett Promotions. We love tag team wrestling. Y'all love tag team wrestling.
Yeah, as you could just see from the top 10.
Yeah, you know, we have 10 tag teams to even rank, you know. Even if one's Norman the Lunatic and the Juicer, we got 10 tag teams. So we love tag team wrestling here. Two, we really want to get the Steiners over real bad. How do we do that? Can someone explain to me why getting the Steiners over? Because the Steiners are awesome at this point in time.
Absolutely.
Scott Steiner is, if a bit sloppy at times, we'll get to that point since the Steiners get the requisite Superstars of Wrestling squash match. If a bit sloppy and careless at times, just a combination of power and athleticism that did not exist.
They had the Brock appeal where you would watch their matches and you didn't know what these guys were going to do and how they were going to throw these guys around.
Well, that's the
and
other thing, too.
Murder guys.
Even if you knew what the spot was going to be, you didn't know how far they'd go, if they'd land on their face, like if someone was kind of going to get potatoed too hard because Steiner went savage and kicked him in the face. Like, it was fun. That seems like a very easy thing to get over. Never mind the fact Rick Steiner's got juice. He was there with Varsity Club. Like, he's already been on the scene, you know, prior to Scott. And Scott's, you know, the newer part of the team is the dynamic engine of the thing, the part that makes you want to watch them.
They had gotten rid of Rick's imaginary friend at this point, so,
so
he's back on track.
Why do we need a fake international tournament to get this over? Because when Starrcade comes, dude, Starrcade 90 sucks because they have to go through a bunch of these stupid, and now representing the nation of Zimbabwe, like Gary Michael Capetta is like announcing like the best tag team from Argentina to come compete.
Are you saying you didn't follow the African tournament, which led up to the African finals on this show?
I was surprised simply because when I saw Public Enemy, I thought like, oh, these guys are in hockey jerseys putting homies through tables. These guys must be from like Philly or the tri-state area. They must be Heyman guys. I did not know that Rocco Rock was actually a pro-white apartheid general. Or wait, excuse me, did I miss... What, Colonel? Is he Colonel de Klerk?
Colonel de Klerk.
My bad, excuse me, I misstated his rank. A racist colonel. Because when I looked at Rocco Rock, I thought, oh, this man's vaguely Hispanic. No, apparently he's Aryan.
What do you think that phone call was like when you got a call, presumably from Oli?
Yeah.
I've got this idea. Go on. So, first of all,
excuse
by the
me,
way,
Mr. Anderson, have you seen me work? You know, like I'm a bigger guy, but I can run up the ropes and do like cannonball, you know, planchas and some.
Son, what the hell's a somersault? You
can
are
you, son. Do you know punch kick, and can you pretend to be South African?
Guys, meet the Botswana beast.
No, this is not the Botswana beast. Can I note this? This man is not... The Botswana Beast is a Kamala ripoff. That's what the Botswana... They put Botswana Beast on the graphic. This man is just some guy named The Beast. They fucked up on the Chiron. This man is not the Botswana Beast. The Botswana Beast is like... He's like... You know how like Kamala 2 is the ripoff Kamala?
Yep.
Botswana Beast is like Kamala 6. This is not him. And the other guy... What's
Kahlua.
Kahlua is some jobber named Bill Tabb.
Bill Tabb and the Beast, just the Beast, against Colonel de Klerk and Sergeant Kruger. Sergeant Kruger.
By the way, these guys aren't even good racist South Africans, because if they were good, like Colonel de Beers, they would refuse to wrestle the black guys and left and lost.
They would have gone Colonel
did,
de Beers.
They did nothing racist.
Did you notice that Kruger and the Klerk were billed from Johannesburg and Kahlua and the Beast were just simply billed from Africa?
Africa. Yes.
Well, great to decipher that. Me being from Toronto, Jordan is from Canada. Jim Ross, clearly, at the start of this, did not know who was who amongst these four. And dangerously,
why would you?
Dangerously asks, who paid for all these plane tickets for these four to come from Africa?
Okay, this, I'm happy you brought this up. This is one of those moments, like I refer to this like it's a Jesse Ventura moment, where the suspension of disbelief, like the casual suspension of disbelief in pro wrestling, no longer, like suddenly there's a cognitive dissonance between that and like basic human logic. There's a fracture. And if you wanna, you know, like there's a cut and you can get in there and stick your finger in and just make it stream blood. Mm-hmm. And Jesse Ventura was the best at this, you know, like exploiting something stupid, asking like McMahon, well, like, well, why can that happen, McMahon? Well, don't you think that's kind of backwards? That's kind of weird. And Vince, you know, is trying to save kayfabe, and you know he's about to have an aneurysm on commentary. This is one of those moments because Heyman badgers Jim Ross repeatedly about basically WCW's decision to fly all these, and without saying as much, basically kind of insinuates like, why would you fly all these shitty guys in from Africa? Like, why can't we go places? Why can't I get more money?
A pointless tournament involving cross-country, cross-global plane flights. This was really a foreboding of Bellator under Bjorn Rebny.
Yeah, absolutely this was. Except for the fact in Bellator, no one hit, like, a cannonball, like run-up-the-ring cannonball, turn-around dive like they do in this. Dude, imagine you're in Jacksonville, Florida. Okay. Also, imagine you're an NWA WCW fan. So imagine you're conditioned to believe, like let's say you're a smarter fan. You know, you see the Beast and Kahlua come out for the Pat O'Connor Memorial Tournament against two racist South Africans, and you're like, oh fuck, I know what this is about. You know, these guys are just gonna go to Starrcade. This is some filler stuff. You know what's up. Okay, imagine that's your mindset. You're in Jacksonville, Florida. One of these racist South African guys starts doing fucking Lucia spots. Like, what is your reaction?
This, if you just are simply going through your programming and you were to stop on any of some of these stereotypes that they pushed, and 1990, I consider it kind of modern. And it was, what a disconnect from the real world that there was, that this was what was happening on professional wrestling in 1990 from WCW on a pretty major media platform.
Yeah, they had, and there's a way to do quote unquote racist gimmicks with a certain level of soft handedness and make it work. More on this when we get to our main event and what I think is one of the biggest fuck ups of this era. But in the meantime, we have a fucked up match that these South African wins. It's terrible. Yeah. I think Rocco Rock makes the pin with some kind of
Kruger drop kicked the clerk right on the top, and then the Beast got the pinfall. 450. Crowd was really dead throughout this, and if anything, here at the end of this, well, next time Kruger and the clerk fight, you can pay to watch them in multiple matches potentially at the Pat O'Connor International Tag Tournament next month.
5 minutes or less for all those bad boys at Starrcade 90. And as teased, you know, we were teasing Luger on the hotline earlier, but we were also teasing the Motor City Madman in the ring.
That's true. He was coming up. We got a video message from one Sam Mushnick inviting everyone to the Kiel Auditorium for the Pat O'Connor tournament.
Sam Mushnick looks like an undead hologram.
This was one of the, I mean, first times I've actually heard Sam Mushnick speak. I mean, not
his voice was adorable.
Oh, absolutely.
Wanted to hug him. But you see this man, arguably, you know, the greatest, like, classic pro wrestling promoter ever.
And following that match.
Dude, and
this just really takes you back to those days at the wrestling at the Chase with the Beast and Kahlua against the racist South Africans. Then there was a video on Stan Hansen and Lex Luger capping off their feud with the U.S. title being dropped to Hansen at Halloween Havoc. And then Pauly dangerously goes to a pool hall to recruit the Motor City Madman with a light conveniently disguising his identity and referring to dangerously as a yuppie. But the Motor City Madman signs up for this, and he is going to take on Lex Luger tonight. Mike Moore, the Motor City Madman.
I also like the suspension of disbelief here in that, so Luger just ended this monstrously long, or is this before his major U.S. title reign?
This was after he had the run and dropped the title to Hansen at Havoc.
Yeah, okay. So he just, you know, ended being the longest U.S. champion still ever, like, you know, a year and a half or something like that, in quite possibly the best feud of his career. And he's going to wrestle on Clash of the Champions. Not only are you getting him a jobber, but we have to go through a vignette to rationalize getting him a jobber.
Yes, he was interviewed by Tony Schiavone. He has the rematch with Hansen coming up at Starrcade with multiple programs all going at once for one Lex Luger, one of which was the Big Cat, who comes out. Luger drops him with one shot.
Yep.
And then Big Cat says that Luger made a big mistake. I would say many people made a big mistake involving
Motor City
Curtis
Madman.
Hughes.
To be fair, Motor City Madman made most of the mistakes in this one. You're just talking about a big bouncer in dungarees wearing weightlifting gloves, who, you know, not the worst mover in the world, but like not a great wrestler. Just the most baseline amount of competence. However, great pro wrestling isn't just about competence. You know what I mean? And this is an era, and we're going to get to the importance of timing very quickly. We have to talk about, well, my spirit animals, the Nasty Boys. But after that, we'll talk about timing and the importance thereof. But the Motor City Madman, the finish of this dude runs in the corner, or he runs Luger into the corner. The finish is the second of three, I'm going to feed with you, I'm going to steal your shit and be the finisher stealer guy. The finish is supposed to be that he slams Luger's head into the turnbuckle. Luger no-sells it and turns around and just gives him the lariat and pins him. Motor City Madman hits Luger's face in the turnbuckle. Luger no-sells it instantly and is ready to go. The Motor City Madman takes, like, the longest casual stroll away from the corner. So Luger just has to stand there and wait while the crowd is screaming hot, knowing that Luger is about to smash him. Then when he turns around, he takes like an awkward long step into Luger while Luger tries to run, so Luger can't even lariat him properly. It almost sounds like a borderline STO, like running him over.
He is already arching back to take the lariat before Luger has even overextended the arm.
He's walking forward while moving back.
It looked terrible in real time.
Yeah.
So
they show a replay.
Moron in the truck says slow motion replay. This looked hideously bad. 2.5 minutes this went. All you need to do is see this slow motion replay. I mean, it looked horrendous the first time around.
Yeah.
To his credit, Jim Ross, at the beginning of this mess, warned everybody this will not be a pretty wrestling match. And to me, Jim Ross, he would always protect his credibility because it established that trust with the audience that, listen, I will tell you when stuff is not great. Mm-hmm. So that when stuff is great and I say so, you're going to have some stake attached to what I say with you.
Yeah.
And he always was very good with that. This match,
it happened.
It is perfectly encapulated with that slow motion replay.
I actually undersold things earlier. I said that Curtis Hughes had two appearances. He has three because we just got by the second one, and we aren't to Curtis Hughes' worst appearance yet.
Yeah, this was.
You told me, by the way, we were about to do this. You told me he had issues with narcolepsy. You think he fell asleep in the back during any of this?
That had always been the rap on this guy, was that he battled issues with narcolepsy.
Which makes sense when you think of the fact that physically, one thing we should say for Curtis Hughes, Curtis Hughes is a real athlete. You know what I mean? There's some guys, and what I mean to say is, I'm going to compare him to Bobby Lashley. Not because they're black and I'm racist, but because they're two different kinds of big-bodied dudes. Bobby Lashley is not supposed to be that size. Bobby Lashley looks like a tiny man trapped in a big, rock-hard suit of, like, sausage-shaped muscles.
Kind of like Teddy Long at this point in time. Because I can tell you, that man did not match his body type in 1990.
No, that's definitely a fair assessment as well. But with Curtis Hughes, dude, this guy's rib cage, his shoulders, like, he is physically massive. Like, he's not, like, naturally ripped up. He is, like, Cedric Alexander twice the size. Like, he's just a physically powerful man.
And probably in person, probably look great in person.
It's not like he can't move. It's not like he doesn't. He has good functional strength. Like when he does like the Volkov backbreaker spot, he's not one of those awkward guys that you can tell is kind of like fighting against his weird body. Like he's smooth. He's just not a good pro wrestler. It makes me kind of think like, yeah, maybe that's why I put sunglasses on him and made him a bouncer for most of it, or like a bodyguard for most of his career.
Shivani is then with Nick Patrick, and they've been having problems with the Steiner brothers and Nasty Boys. They've been threatened with fines, and the Steiners...
Nick Patrick says the Steiners are the worst of it. Getting the faces over is quasi-heelish.
Absolutely, and that the Steiners are out to end the careers of Jerry Sags and Brian Knobs.
I won't hear of it. They're my guys.
And they were up next, taking on the Renegade Warriors.
Taking on some racist Native Americans.
Jim Ross says he will quit announcing if the Nasty Boys lose to the Steiners, probably very aware of their contract situation coming
soon. They win against the Steiners.
They win against the Steiners, sorry.
Yeah, these guys are bound for the WWE. I'm not going to get a platform anywhere else to say this. John Pollock, how do you feel about the Nasty Boys?
Listen, the Nasty Boys have always been a fun tag team. I'm not as negative on them as others are, but I know you, a huge fan of Knobs and Sags. And having met, especially Brian Knobs in person, very funny guy. I mean, horrible stories involving these two and just...
Yeah, they sound like real... Like,
shitty people back in the day.
Yeah, they sound like real dipshit assholes.
Absolutely. But I can say from the times I have interacted with them, they have been very entertaining.
Here's my thing. Dipshit asshole to me is fine. Like, look... This is a circus, you know what I mean? I'm sure the fire breather tweaks the nipples of the bearded lady sometimes and they get in beef and it's whatever, you know? I'm not saying beat up Ken Shamrock with a phone. I'm saying I know how these things happen. To me, the real pro wrestling sins aren't dusting boys on the road and ribbing them and getting shit like that. It's structural violence. It's the clique ruining the WWF product until Hall and Nash left. It's Shawn Michaels submarining Bret Hart. It's like all these kinds of things, you know? It's you know, the honky tonk man preventing Ted DiBiase from having a world title. It's shit like that that is the real criminal offense. Also, in terms of a gimmick, like the Nasty Boys is a pro wrestling gimmick.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? However, in terms of people who actually embody their pro wrestling gimmick, name a more natural synergy. Like CM Punk.
Yeah, I mean, you know? These guys were, I mean,
trash pieces of shit who just act like white trash pieces of shit. They're the nat. They have gross name. Dude, they have the perfect pro wrestling names too because they're the anti-Vince McMahon names. Jerry, dude, Brian Knobs and Jerry Sags sound like impossibly, at best, they sound like shock DJs and not even good ones. At worst, they sound kind of like low trash skis bags that own a bowling alley slash strip club. These are not if Vince McMahon came up with the Nasty Boys, they'd be named like, you know, Geraldovis Slime or so, you know what I mean? Like, but Knobs, dude, Knobs and Sags, the Nasty Boys. Dude, their gear. They wrestle in trunks with Jackson Pollock tank tops, basically, underneath leather dusters, basically. They're dressed like a combination of, like the kind of 80s punks you get in movies, but the 80s punks you get in movies that are, like, sci-fi dystopias. Like, they're dressed like Clarence Bedeker's baddies in RoboCop.
I was going to say, I mean, they felt like two characters off of, like two of the villains off of, like, the Cops cartoon or something.
And John Pollock, look in my eyes, look in my hair. Tell me this haircut that I have had for almost a decade is not the best.
It's fantastic, George.
If you had to describe this haircut as anything, would you not describe it as a Nasty Boys haircut? Apart from the fact I need to get clipped up on the sides.
I would say that particular hairstyle, an ode to one Knobs and Jerry Sags.
It is. Dude, my hair is literally a direct ode to the Nasty Boys.
And they were a cartoon two cartoon characters that transferred over to professional wrestling.
Perfectly.
And look at the difference between them and, say, a Disorderly Conduct.
Yeah.
And the difference.
And the other thing, too, is they sell out for it. You know what I mean? Like, when you watch them, dude, even in this, when you watch Knobs and Sags, even in jobber matches, or, you know, like, they're on their way out here, you know, they're just trying to put the Steiners over and get out of the territory or whatever, they still try. Because they're weird dudes that like going in, like beating people up and getting sweaty and being gross.
And there were some tag matches they had, especially with like brawls, you know,
yeah,
with your
dude.
Cactus Jacks and Max Payne's.
This is what I was getting to, and we're going to, we can talk about this with Sid in a minute. There are some guys, like, and it goes back to mixed martial arts. I talked a bit about this with the UFC 189 Beat Time After the Bell with the homie Patrick Wyman for Sure Dog. You know, you can train all you want, you can learn all the technique you want, you can learn the philosophy and the underpinnings and the history of things. In mixed martial arts, there really is no – you can be great without it, but at the end of the day, there really isn't quite a substitute for being hard.
Mm-hmm.
You're
going
to fight in a cage for a living. Being hard is invaluable. It's not dissimilar from pro wrestling. Not necessarily pure hardness, but if you're going to do this for a living, you kind of got to be about the business and sell out for the idea like, I like beating the shit out of people. I hope you want to beat the shit out of me. You know, you want like the classic Johnny Valentine who like people are punching him in the face and he's like, harder. You know, in front of 20,000 people who think it's real.
Yeah.
The Nasty Boys, when they get out there, you watch their brawls, the concession stand brawl. Dude, they just look like they're having fun, A, beating the shit out of people, and B, getting the shit beat out of them. Like, it seems fun. It seems violent. It is everything you want. Like, they're sloppy and gross and obviously hurt people because of that. I'm not going to act like they're great workers. But for a gimmick, for guys that can work a certain kind of match and transcend and be better than themselves as a team, the Nasty Boys rule.
Well, and there's always an argument I make that there are certain characters that the idea of them being fluid workers would completely
yes.
counteract the gimmick.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
The Nasty Boys are as good an example as any. I mean, if those guys were Greco-Roman wrestlers that were put into that gimmick, if Mike Rotunda was put in as one of the Nasty Boys, I mean, they're sloppiness there. I mean, these were guys off the street that were brawling with credentialed professional wrestlers.
But again,
I mean,
it goes back to the little
world.
Stuff. You can take a fat guy and give him the mullet hawk hairstyle and whatever, but you can't make him a Nasty Boy. You know what I mean? Like, dude, Sags and Knobs are actually gross. Like, when they scream at the crowd, they spit. They're incredibly sweaty dudes, even by pro wrestling standards. Sags is missing tooth. You know,
the pit stop thing was grotesque.
Dude, that's a rib spot that you do to someone like a joke about in the back. Not like your actual moveset. Like you're wrestling a jobber that you're never going to work with ever again in like Topeka, Kansas. And you force his face. This man has kids. Force his face into your fucking armpit. It's ridiculous. The Nasty
Boys.
Well,
then Rikishi came along.
The Nasty Boys are awesome. Tag teams in their essence. Like, you know, you hope sometimes a tag team wrestling, you find a gem, or maybe two, and you can split them up and do things, and they go on to greater things. But at the end of the day, tag team wrestling at its heart is about elevating two things to being greater than the sum of their parts. The Nasty Boys, like Jerry Sags or Brian Knobs on their own, that ain't shit. The Nasty Boys as a tandem. One black, one blonde, one's got all his teeth, they kind of stink, the other one's missing one, matching dusters, beautiful matching dusters, and maybe the best annoying entrance music in history.
Like, I always enjoyed their theme music.
Dude, their entrance music is literally like the hologram material that used to get on like school agendas and stuff when you like scrape your nails across it. Like you can act like it's a record scratch. It's not. It's even worse than that.
So they were taking on the Renegade Warriors, Chris and Mark Youngblood. Chris is in. He hits a crossbody in the middle of the ring, and the opponent was there to take the crossbody this time around. They attacked the arm of Knobs, then they isolated the arm of Sags, tossed Mark over, and then Knobs sends him into the barricade. They attack him back into the ring. Referee misses the Youngblood tag as they double-team Mark, hits a shoulder breaker, and then the Steiners run down, having seen enough of this.
Heel Steiners!
Attack the Nasty Boys for the DQ. There's this crazy call by Jim Ross, and running
if
down...
If they're so tough, why can't they fight? Why are they so scared?
Runs down the Nasty Boys for being cowards as this match is thrown out at 4 minutes and 58 seconds.
The Nasty Boys ran all the way to WrestleMania to win the titles from the Hart Foundation. Can't say it was a bad idea. And they picked up a pretty good manager, which, by the way, you know, Nasty Boys, too, good example of a tag team that work with and without a manager. On their own, kind of like lone, gross renegades, it makes sense that they'd be by themselves, you know, smoking crystal meth, getting in fights on the street. But with a manager, you just kind of think like, oh, Jimmy Hart's so devious. Where do you even find pieces of shit like this?
And Jimmy Hart was just such a great chameleon, because he was with like 7 guys, and he could go from Nasty Boys Jimmy Hart to Earthquake
Jimmy Hart. But it suited him, because you have like the default Jimmy Hart, but you also have the fact that like part of Jimmy Hart's character is that he's kind of a try too hard knob who just wants to get in on whatever. So like it makes sense that this guy who's like, kind of like this sniveling loser who wants to be down would hang out with the Nasty Boys and be like, oh boys, I bought a bike, I got a helmet.
Yeah.
It makes sense that, like, you get with a honky-tonk man and be like, I own all the Elvis records, baby. I love Elvis.
I'm a Canadian. Here's the Mountie.
Yeah.
Then we go to the unofficial main event of the show.
Oh, fuck.
The Night Stalker and Sid Vicious.
So, I gotta say, I've been hyping it. I think, I told you.
This was your reason for choosing
this
show.
Yes, this is what made me decide above any other show, from this era. This is why Clash of Champions 13. This is a certified, and at a time where I don't want to say that it's easier now or harder now to get -5 or +5 stars, but this was a fairly selective time for the Wrestling Observer. This is even pre giving out 5-star matches like hotcakes to all the All Japan guys, because we know what Big Dave likes. Big Dave likes big Japanese guys and big spots. It's even before, you know, Mizawa and Kobashi and Kawada and Taui and all these guys go apeshit. This is a point where it's hard to get 5-star anything, never mind -5 stars. This is a certified -5-star classic right here, dude. And I think, again, adjusting for the context, I think it's the worst pro wrestling match ever. Because when I've seen other bad pro wrestling matches, like worst ever type stuff, like that Jackie Gata tag match.
That one comes to mind.
Okay, but like, so is that Nowinski and Bradshaw? Is that who's in that?
It's Trish and Bradshaw against Nowinski and Gata.
Okay, so that one, like, that being shit has nothing to do with the three workers who are good, really.
No, that was essentially, I mean, Jackie Gata threw everybody onto different pages.
Yeah.
And it was just, and it was on live television, and it's just, if you ever want to see a match just fully full fall apart at the seams. That's it.
But that's like in network, you know, homie coming apart. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. Like, that's one person who's like waving a gun like a terrorist, sabotaging everything. I mentioned to you, I've seen a Zeus Abdullah the Butcher match from Puerto Rico, which is, I mean, you can make fun of punch, kick, punch, kick, punch, kick, punch, kick, punch, kick, but this is a disgrace to punch, kick, punch, kick, punch, kick, punch, kick, punch, kick. I don't even think we get a fork spot. You know, it's the worst. But Abdullah the Butcher can't work. Zeus can't work. In terms of two guys that were like 20-year pro wrestling veterans, I know that Sid's, you know, only been in the game for a bit, and Brian Clark is quite obviously pretty green in this match. For guys that would actually go on to do this, this is what they do. Hey, man, what are you? What were you in your past life? I'm a pro wrestler. You see them on the street. Oh, that's Sid Justice, Sid Vicious, that's Wrath, that's Adam Bomb. These men are pro wrestlers. They do this. And for the most part, not great workers, especially not Brian Clark. But Sid, you know, again, not great. He broke his leg jumping off a top rope trying to do a flying teep. He's a bit of a moron. But in the scale of, like, really big workers, he's not the worst.
Had his handful of good matches, depending on who he was sharing a ring with.
A dude that could be transformed by a real transformative worker. So, adjusting for those factors, like two actual professionals that are going to do this shit for the rest of their life, this is the worst. However, It gets extra points because this involves a third man, and I don't mean referee Randy Anderson, who's also fucking terrible in this. I mean Curtis Hughes, who has stayed awake long enough to grace us with his presence.
It's getting late by this time, too.
For the third point and the worst of all. Do you want to go through the spots of this match?
I will go.
Real quick, by the way. Do you notice that the Night Stalker has a manager?
The Night Stalker was trained by Ox Baker, but they announced that he is not cornering him tonight.
It says on the Chiron, the Night Stalker with Ox Baker.
He's at home watching this. He didn't even want to be a part of this. Taking on the man from anywhere he darn well chooses, Sid Vicious, part of the Horsemen at this point. We had an insert promo for him where he is going after Sting once he gets through with the Night Stalker.
Was he the master and the ruler of something? Did he mention?
This was in amazing because we had Luger and Sting in like all these different programs as we were a month out from like
their biggest show,
the climax point of the year.
Yep. And that's also not the only thing that's weird about this match. One of the things that also makes this match suffer, and this is like has to be brought up, because the working is terrible, the timing is really what kills this. There's like a million, everything sucks shit about this match. It is the worst, but the timing is the worst. However, one underrated, invisible piece of why this sucks is he's part of the Horsemen, but the Horsemen are kind of face at this point in time.
Especially on this card, yeah.
So Sid has never been a proper face before. Doesn't know what the fuck he's doing and doesn't know how to work a non-heel match. And that is a huge part of why this sucks so badly, because Sid has no idea how to sell and no idea how to be a face and work face offense.
Jim Ross with the Jim Ross disclaimer. It's not going to be the prettiest match on the card.
Jim Ross, you have no idea.
No, he was Nostradamus here. There was a bear hug by the Night Stalker.
Oh, no, you're skipping ahead.
After the test of strength?
There was a test of strength.
With horrible kicks to the body.
Yes, okay, so this is there's no reason to ever do a test of strength unless you're playing WCW Thunder, the video game. Do you know what I'm talking about, by the way?
I've never played the WCW Thunder
video
game.
If you play WCW Thunder,
the
video game, the test of strength is the best move in the game.
Oh, that's really selling me
on that
game.
If you get in a test of strength, all you obviously have to do is button mash, and then you put the guy down, and it stuns them, and it takes off a big part of their health, so you can just spam. Oh, also, if you win the test of strength, you get health back.
Oh.
So if you just spam the test, literally.
It's like osmosis of strength.
Yeah. In WCW Thunder, if you beat Goldberg and do the test of strength four times, spear jackhammer, every match.
Do you know how over that spot would have been for a small window of time if they gave one guy just 5 weeks of television where he submitted a guy with a test of strength? I mean, to this day, that would always be in the recesses of your mind that, hey, man, remember when Sid just beat all those guys with that test of strength? It's like when they do a countout during one match of the G1. And for every other match for the rest of the year, when they tease a countout, it's always in the back of their head. They did it once.
Yeah. That's good. Shoutouts to Jado and Gato. That's good booking. You do things so people have the sense of dude, that could actually happen. Sid kicks. We'll get to Sid's kicks will come in their own time here. I'll get to them. But first.
Oh, you take the kicks because I'll go on the punches because there's lots of his offense that you can marvel over. Holy Christ.
So let's get to this part.
This guy and limbs were just a horrendous relationship.
Before we get to what I think is the worst bear hug in the history of pro wrestling and maybe the worst pro wrestling match ever, Sid, is it fair to call Sid the worst kayfabe striker in history?
He has.
Dude,
he is the Jake Shields of professional wrestling offense.
Jake Shields' leg kicks look better than this. Dude, this is how you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that the squeegee and scissors stories are true. The way that Sid punches and kicks, this is how you also know that it's true that he loves softball more than pro wrestling. Never mind his declarations of such. You know all you need to know about Sid not being that guy, not being a nasty boy, basically.
Yes.
This is how you know Sid isn't a nasty boy. Watching him punch and kick, it is abundantly clear that Sid, by virtue of his size and jockery, has never really actually been beat up in his life. Sid's clearly never been in a fight because he clearly has no idea how to punch and kick people.
And those
or sell. That's another thing. Big guys tend to be the worst at selling, and one reason I think it is a lot of big guys don't, people don't step to them, or if they do, they beat them up. You don't actually, hard men, who can go back and forth. Dude, even though he developed a reputation late in his career, for obviously no song because it's part of the gimmick, dude, you watch fucking, Mangus Haku, he can sell. He knows what it's like to get in a fight and rip a man's eyeball out.
Sid would also have this... this technique when he would be selling something that he just like shake his head like he got and grab a sign in his eye.
Yeah.
And it was like the guy needed a Claritin rather than anything. And
so he's got some allergies, dude.
These habits that must have been formed at day one of training
and never got
persisted. Entire career, the punches, the selling, it all just stuck with this guy. And I don't know if he was just a rock rather than a sponge when it came to learning, because he never adjusted.
Well, dude, even the classic pay-per-view, I'm going to do that again. We're Kevin Kelly, we're live. And it's just like, it's like, dude, like you're a pro wrestler. Number one, you were in the fucking Horsemen with Rick and Arn. You should know, number one, nail your promo, be ready.
Listen, this was a guy who I'm sure he showed up at a wrestling locker room and he realized on day one, I am half the man that you are. So glad you connected the dots so quickly.
That's the best kind of stitchback, because that's a future stitchback. He hasn't even done that shit yet at this point in time.
That was 9 years away, that promo.
But part of the problem here is that he's actually not half the man Brian Clark is. That's part of the problem.
Debatable on this one. Brian Clark is pretty goddamn terrible.
He's terrible, but he's not half the man. Because if he was half the man, he'd be smaller. He would throw better punches and kicks. And two, most important to this, if he was half the man Brian Clark was, his feet wouldn't have been on the ground while Brian Clark attempted a 31-second bear hug, which, I mean, isn't this match?
Dude, we're at like the second spot of this match.
Okay, this match is just over. It's like 3 minutes and 17 seconds or something, right?
3:30. I've got down here.
Okay,
yeah.
The first bear hug is 30 seconds. Sid breaks it with the bell ringer.
Of course.
Brian Clark puts the bear hug back on. I'm fucking not kidding. He tries to pick Sid up off the ground. Brian Clark's like 6'4". Sid's like 6'8". And Sid's legs are on the ground within 8 seconds, and then they're just standing there. And then there's an awkward spot where they lean on each other and are clearly calling this match, which I can only imagine the content of the conversation, since this is, again, the worst match I've ever seen.
So the arm of Sid gets snapped on the top rope, and then Brian Clark attacks the ribs.
It's the psychology portion of the match. This is time for the Ric Flair segment where we start working the injury. Which, by the way, did Sid have a kayfabe rib injury? Paulie Dangerously screams his lungs out and sells so hard for Sid's ribs. Paul Heyman, actually, you know what? I'm going to make this even worse. I'm going to say that Paul Heyman is the fifth man in this match, because this shit, you just mentioned that one of Jim Ross's virtues is knowing when to dial it back. Ladies and gentlemen, we're not going to see too many arm drags and flying drop kicks here in this one.
Dangerously?
Complete fucking opposite. Dude, you would think you were watching Lou Thesz in there working the shooter's magic against a compromised opponent as Brian Clark delivers the worst knee lifts in the history of time to Sid Vicious's ribcage, which again, was there a rib injury here? What?
I was not familiar at all.
I Googled it. I
couldn't
find anything.
With a punctured lung. And going back to your point about the fact that here we are creating sympathy on Sid Vicious, that the crowd is not conditioned to have sympathy.
His name is Sid fucking Vicious.
I mean, that's where things end. And I mean, of all the body parts you isolate, I mean, the lung, I mean, pretty ambitious on their part here for storytelling, which I would give 50-50 odds, the two workers in the ring were not even aware they were doing a match built around the injured lung of Sid Vicious that may or may not have existed, that Dangerously just created here to make some kind of story.
They're doing a dance around an effigy of burning shit, and the effigy of shit is about to start to melt and drip everywhere, because after that spot's over, Sid sells the ribs super awkwardly for a second, and they also should point out, we're not actually making this sound as bad as it is, because we're mentioning the individual parts, and I mentioned the timing's bad. The timing is, it's like explaining a video game and saying that the controls suck. You know, even if you're watching the video, you're just bad at the game. You're just jumping in the pit. You can't feel how unresponsive it is. So when we say that Sid is the worst kayfabe striker ever, you might know what it looks like when Sid, like, throws his hands down and throws, like, an awkward front kick the way that Sid tends to, and then, like, throws two or three in a row like he's the worst Muay Thai fighter in history. But you don't know what it's like when Sid goes to throw a punch but has to, like, literally slow down to half speed midway through so Brian Clark can realize, like, move out of the way and then knee him in the ribs. Like, the timing is, it's so bad. And then, John, it's about to get worse, because after this, they back up, they're beating each other up, And it happens. The big cat's back, and Pauly dangerously yells, "I think I taw a putty tat," at the top of his lungs at least twice.
I mean, at the very least, the cat came back could have been a better go-to.
The cat came back the very next match would have been the dagger.
We forgot to include the Night Stalker, of course. Can't just come to the ring alone.
He's got an axe.
He's got like a medieval battle axe that looks to be made out of plastic that or may not have used at that year's Halloween.
Well, I was going to say, dude, isn't it the same executioner's one they use for like Black Blood or whatever, like the Billy Jack Haynes thing? Or did he have like a different, did he have like more like an executioner's one?
Are you talking executioner, Terry Gordy executioner?
No, I'm talking they had a gimmick in like 89 or 90. I think it was like Billy Jack Haynes as Black Blood, and he did like an executioner gimmick, I think.
Oh, that's right. I can't remember
if he had an executioner's axe with like the one side with like the piece, or if it was double sided like this one.
I saw none of that character. So
the axe. You know, sometimes an inanimate object is a respectable worker in a match. DDT. You know, the pencil against Brian Pillman.
Sure.
Pencil was over against Brian. Pencil was hot against Pillman. The axe. Not hot, but still probably the best part of this match.
Which, what a tie-in to Raw last week with Brock Lesnar destroying that Cadillac. I mean, maybe there was something to this axe. Maybe they knew ahead of time what we were going to be reviewing the following week.
So, they're beating each other up on the far side of the ring. Sid is facing the ramp. Also, keep in mind, if you've never seen, John called it the prom entrance. If you've never seen an NWA WCW event from this period, how long would you say the ramp is? 40, 50 yards? Like half a fucking football field?
Like medals have been given out for people going down said entrance in a fast enough speed.
Okay, so keep in mind too, Curtis Hughes is not running down to like, you know, make a save or anything like that. He's strolling down the ramp.
He might have been sleepwalking.
He's somnambulating down the ramp. Sid, you know, again, maybe he had something in his eyes. He needs the clarity. He's got his vision's hazy. He's got some cat hair in his face or something. He should clearly be able to see the giant man, the giant black man moving down the giant white ramp directly in front of his fucking face. But he can't. So
the Night Stalker gets his axe. Do you want to pick up from
okay,
there?
Okay, no, I got this whole thing. So,
go for it.
Curtis Hughes hits the ring, gets to the apron. Sid and Brian Clark are still hitting one another, but because Hughes has now got to the ring, which, again, why? Why is he trying to get in on everyone else's program? Luger's already got a program with Stan Hansen. They're at Starrcade next month, bro.
The match has been announced.
What are you doing now with Sid? Curtis Hughes, try less hard. Little less oomph. Might go a long way. So he hits the ring. Brian Clark has to stop engaging Sid, so Sid can just turn around and go hit Curtis Hughes. So Brian Clark just, you know, basically stops moving and stands there, pretends like he's not in a wrestling match, so Sid can move across the ring and attack Curtis Hughes. Again, same shit like Luger. He basically takes one shot and, like a pussy, just falls down, apparently playing Big 12 football at K-State's easy, you know, defensive lineman. You just don't get hit in the face ever, lest you fall down and cry. Like Curtis Hughes does. Then, as Sid is embroiled with hitting Curtis Hughes, this has given Brian Clark time to go grab his double-sided axe, which he, you know, suggestively flips around in his hands as though he's going to decapitate Sid.
Which, my God, I wouldn't have trusted these two to pull off any of this, plastic axe or not.
Pollock, would you like to guess at this point in time where referee Randy Anderson is?
I didn't know. Randy Anderson, through the use of a fatal object, his vision was impaired. It had to have been a physical ailment that Randy Anderson was suffering from.
Dude,
at the 3:15 mark of this 3.5-minute match.
He's just like standing there. Like he's just like oblivious. So, okay.
They fought over an axe and an axe was used to lead to the finish with Randy Anderson conscious.
So
standing in the fucking ring.
Okay, so here's the very end. The bitter, bitterest end as Paul grabs his head in pain. Clark, he night stalks. It's the evening. He stalks towards Sid Vicious with this giant axe, which, by the way, he's not going to swing. He's obviously going to use the handle.
Of course. Using the sting bat technique.
So he looms over with the axe. Now, Sid turns around. Brian Clark, rather than reacting, again, the timing issue, rather than reacting and, like, going for a lunge and letting it finish, it's this sense of, like, you know, it's what happens when wrestlers aren't good and haven't worked with good workers. Like, you just don't trust the other guy or don't know that the other guy's going to hold up his end of the bargain. Sid's going to kick you in the stomach, bro. Just swing the fucking axe. You don't have to get to the apex of your swing and wait, like, do it now, Sid. Sid's not good, but he's been doing it long enough to know to kick you in the stomach when you pick it up. So Clark picks it up and then just freezes. Sid almost gives it, like him freezing almost freezes Sid, like, oh, right, the kick. Sid kicks him. We've already talked about how bad Sid's striking is, so it's kind of remarkable that this 6'4", 6'4", 6'5", 300-pound man is doubled over for several seconds, frozen, paralyzed from his kick. The kick allows Sid to pick up the axe in plain view. Keep in mind at this point, Randy Anderson could have disqualified the Night Stalker for attempting to use the axe. At this point, Sid picks up the axe. He hits Curtis fucking Hughes with the axe. Curtis Hughes, who's taken one punch in the last 6-7 seconds, is still selling the punch. He just stands there and gets hit with the axe. Then, Brian Clark, who's still selling the kick from 2.5 seconds earlier, still standing there, takes the axe bump. Sid hits him soft as shit, basically with a broomstick. And he goes down. Randy Anderson sees both of these things. At this point, he could have disqualified Brian Clark, disqualified Brian Clark for having Curtis Hughes interfere or using the axe, disqualified Sid for using it, declared a no contest because this has devolved into absolute fuckery with a double-sided axe in a pro wrestling ring.
Not to mention,
in plain sight,
the last match we just watched featured a run-in where the bell was immediately called for. That was what we put right on before this match to do a finish with another run-in at the end.
Sid hits both of them with the axe. It looks positively pathetic. Brian Clark goes down. Terrible-looking pinfall. 1, 2, 3. In 3 minutes and 3:30, whatever.
That was 3.5 minutes, what we just recapped.
Dude.
210 seconds.
Dude. That match is fucking... Okay, so like when I asked you to do this, I assume that you were aware that this match was bad. You
know, I knew. I had seen... I believe I have seen this match before, but talking years and years ago.
Okay, but do you feel... One, do you think we've over or undersold this or appropriately sold this on this broadcast? And two, were you surprised in watching it how much worse it was than like what you expected going in?
It was certainly at about what my expectation and memory level was. In terms of the worst match ever, I have a hard time giving this that particular
nod. What do you got off the top and why?
One of my go-tos would certainly be Sheik and Volkov against Bushwhackers, Heroes of Wrestling.
Okay, again, this is why I said, thinking about context. When I said context, I used the example of like...
I get it.
Heroes of fucking Wrestling is obviously exempt. Heroes of Wrestling is in its own special class of... Dude, you're talking about middle-aged men, some of whom are literally near death, and they're wrestling. Of course it's the worst.
If you take in all the variables of two guys in the prime of their athletic careers, which Brian Clark and Sid Udy would have been in 1990, you make a very compelling argument.
Like, I'm not saying these guys are as good as they ever got, but Sid was good enough at least for Vince to look at him and see him as the champion within a year.
What do you think some of these house show matches looked like when the cameras weren't rolling? Like, there would be, I mean, even...
Well, think
like
about
anything.
Everything. Well, think about... Dude, you've read The Observer from that. There's tidbits in The Observer like, you know, NWA/WCW did a show, you know, in Roanoke, Virginia that drew 150 people.
What do you think these... When the cameras weren't rolling, what the mentality was? Because I'll tell you, even today, there are performers that... You know, cameras aren't rolling. It's like, hey, I've got to keep my body healthy. It's like, I'm not going all out. In 1990, with your Sids of the world, with your Brian Clarks, with a number of guys on this particular roster.
Well, Sid extra, too, because this is a guy that doesn't want to be doing this. This is a guy that's doing this because he's huge and he's got the look. If this guy could play in the pro softball league, this is where he'd be at.
The fact that these two would occupy the same roster in the WWF in 95 and then later WCW.
The fact that they would occupy major rosters for 20 years is
Meanwhile, there has to be another televised match involving these two, whether it be Adam Bomb and Sid and Psycho Sid, whether it was Sid Vicious and Chronic Brian yep. Clark. Please, folks, if it exists out there, please send along. I would love to see the rematch.
On the Chronic tip, I find it hard to believe that the Gonge wouldn't have instrumentally helped Brian Clark in this. Because, like, dude, chill out. Again, like, going back to the axe spot, chill out and relax. Have faith that Sid's going to kick you. You know what I mean? If this dude had smoked a blunt before this, this might not have been the biggest catastrophe in the history of time.
Well, Brian Clark, amazingly, would go on to have
a career.
A career for, throughout the decade. I mean,
dude, this to me is something, like, if I didn't know who Brian Clark was, and I would assume the story of this would be Ole Anderson saw this guy. They worked him on some house shows. They're like, fuck it, it's a clash. We need a big guy. We'll give him a generic gimmick. He did this. They saw it, and this man became a long-haul truck driver or a high school whatever-the-fuck coach and did not wrestle again. That would be the appropriate end for whoever played the Night Stalker on this night. It's a miracle that Brian Clark had a real pro wrestling career.
Afterwards, they attack Sid after the match, and Sid is knocked to the floor. He goes to grab a chair.
Oh, by the way, I left out something huge about the pin. When he pins Brian Clark, like, you'd think that Curtis Hughes wanted to fuck this all up for Sid. He has to stand there. Sid hits him in the stomach with the axe, I think.
Yep.
He has to stand there doubled over for like 5 seconds while Sid hits Brian Clark, pins him. Like, he just sits there doubled over in the corner. He's on his feet. He's just kind of like grabbing his ribs doubled over, selling a broomstick to the ribs for like 5 seconds. Holy fuck, dude.
He may have just been woken up, though, with a kick to the gut. So, in fairness, he was a little groggy. And then afterwards, Sid remembers to grab his lung and sell the lung on the way to the back.
Well, thank God.
Shivani is with Terry, Jimmy Garvin and Michael Hayes, and bets that El Gigante is in a box on the way to China, insinuating that they've murdered El Gigante.
But they said Argentina earlier.
Yes.
And they say China and this thing. So, like, why, at first, why did you say you were going to send him home? And now, why are you sending him to communist China?
They may not have known the difference, the Freebirds.
It's entirely possible. They can't dance and they look like idiots.
One of the highlights of the show was these two being interrupted by Tracy Smothers and Steve Armstrong with Smothers in
The Zubas.
The Zubas pants with the fanny pack. But then out of nowhere, Gigante returns from China / Argentina.
From the box. It was one of the Black Scorpion's magic boxes. He teleported right back to the venue.
We got that angle still to come.
We got the Steiners in a squash after this, but we still have the best non-wrestling.
Oh my God. I can't believe we still have that to go. And then Tracy Smothers with the line of the night says that Gigante, he's going to beat on you like a duck on a June bug. Ben Rothwell, take note. That's a great post-fight promo.
Like my grandmother used to say, apparently.
Missy Hyatt promotes main event coming up this Sunday.
Be real here. How good does Missy Hyatt look in this promo? Her hair is very 80s, 90s-tastic, like hairspray up the wazoo.
She was bridging that gap of the 80s to the 90s in this this on camera.
She's bridging that gap between my hand and my groin. She looks exquisite in this particular. For someone who is basically, seriously, the reason I bring this up isn't to be just like crass or gross or chauvinistic. Missy Hyatt is, like, you bring her up, people are just like, oh, she's like a gross slut. And that's it. You know what I mean? This woman worked in the business, did shit, and she didn't always look kind of spooky.
I thought Missy Hyatt was always a great character.
Her Twitter is killer, by the way.
Hey, I think she is someone that is fascinating just to, like her understanding of the industry.
Yeah.
That, I mean, a lot of people in the industry, like, you'll talk to them at a certain, like,
base level.
They can't see
the forest from the trees, dude.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. That exists for MMA and professional wrestling, you'll find. And Missy Hyatt is not one of them.
This is the only pro Nasty Boys, pro Missy Hyatt, pro wrestling radio you're going to get probably ever.
It might be. And Missy Hyatt got that tryout in the WWF. I always thought she would have been a tremendous heel foil at the time. And they did have Sherry, but Missy Hyatt...
Dude, Sherry's different, dude. Like, Sherry comes...
Sherry had the physical bumping heel manager.
Dude, Sherry
Missy
was a
Hyatt
wrestler.
Could talk, and...
Sherry was a wrestler who could be a heel. Missy Hyatt was just straight up heel, dude.
Yeah.
And because she was she could still play damsel, there's a way you could... Dude, like, that was a blown opportunity. Missy Hyatt, before she cut her face all up and stuff like that, was beautiful.
I mean, Ted DiBiase and Missy Hyatt, that would have been a great combination. There was a lot you could have done, I think, with Missy Hyatt.
Could have named her after Dusty's first flame. mother of his children.
Sure.
Kept the joke going deeper.
But plugs at this Sunday, it's her and Jim Ross, and they plug on TV this weekend. Arn Anderson against Terry Taylor, which might have been better than anything on this particular show.
I find it hard to believe that it wouldn't have.
Steiner Brothers.
Actually, dude, we do have Flair Reed to come. Flair Reed, it says a monumental amount about the show. Flair Reed, I think, is actually a very good pro wrestling match, especially considering one half of it is Butch Reed.
That was what I was going to say. I mean, Ric Flair, we'll get into it in the main event. The Steiner Brothers taking on...
some guys.
Tim Hunt and Jeff Warner, Magnum Force. Do you want to give the listeners an illustration of Magnum Force?
They very much looked like NWA WCW jobbers. You know,
they were not bridging the gap of the 80s to 90s seamlessly.
They were looking very, very 80s. But at the same time, I find like this and like the Motor City Madman, stuff like that, those tend to be like more of, not that you didn't have the Mulkeys, you know what I mean?
Right.
Mulkeys existed, but I feel like Vince always liked jobbers that like looked pathetic because Vince is like some kind of mentally ill sociopath. Like Vince loves, you know, like kind of like a doughy pathetic, like he loves like Dusty Wolf. You know what I mean? Like, that's Vince's kind of jobber. Like, a guy that, like, today looks like he'd sell cell phones. You know what I mean? Like, Vince loves seeing that guy get the shit beat out of him. NWA WCW jobbers, you got kind of, like, robust guys that look like they try to, like, spike your girlfriend's drink at a bar and then beat you down with a pool stick.
It was also just from the pure visual that here you would have, I mean, look at that late 80s, early 90s. You throw a warlord against...
Yeah,
Johnny Shithead, and I mean, it was just the contrast alone made these characters so much larger than life.
Well, the other thing too is I think it kind of works. I want to say like the opposite, but there's something like when you watch like an WCW event and you see a guy that's kind of a jobber, but still is kind of like robust. Like you see like Pez Watley get the shit beat out of him.
Right.
It's like, dude, Pez Watley looks like a cab driver that could wild on someone. You know, like Pez Watley doesn't look like a complete pussy.
We got Scott Steiner. In Scott Steiner form here.
Dude, that's what we got. This is the man who yelled at you for not calling it a Frankensteiner. He's there in this match, and he is doing work.
More people know about John Pollock from that Botchamania clip than will ever know about anything else I do.
Shout out to Matthew.
Scott hit, and this was like a trademark of his that often gets forgotten, the rotating fall-away slam. I mean, a fall-away slam, great, whatever. Fully rotating, like, moonsault onto the guy upon landing.
And this one, he lands on his fucking neck and no-sells it. Steiner jacks his neck up so bad, and you can tell how bad it hurts, and he just has that moment where he's like, nah, fuck it, bro. Woo! And starts pumping the guns. Steiner, for a guy that is regarded as kind of like a meathead sort of, has anyone ever innovated more fucking moves?
Oh, and the... Like, the margin of error for some of these spots. Like, the Steiner screwdriver...
You took it right out of my mouth. Because that's the thing. He adds... Like, Steiner adds these bells and whistles to moves that are like... Like, because at the end of the day, a Steiner screwdriver is basically a Falcon Arrow.
Yeah.
You know, it's basically a... It was also like a Michinoku Driver 1 kind of...
Yeah.
You know, it's basically that. But, dude, the way he does it and the fact that he literally rotates them as they come down... You're going from, like, a relative chance of a neck injury to, like, extreme chance of neck injury instantaneously.
I mean, it was the late 80s, early 90s of the Steiner Brothers was just, and I mean, you can look at their stuff that they did in Japan, brought back here, dangerously here, threatens to move to Canada because the Steiners are representing America. These fuckers from Detroit, down with those automakers. Rick comes in, just hits a straight right, followed with a Steiner line, and then Scott hits the Frankensteiner. Minute 55, it was just a showcase for the Steiners and a backdrop for a Nasty Boys run-in. As they attacked the Steiners, they brawled in the ring,
and then they get
Nasty Boys fleeing, and clotheslines them to the floor, and the Nasties bail to the back.
And all the way to the WWF tag team titles.
I don't know when they knew the Nasties were on the way out, but you certainly got to see kind of a theme here.
I often
wonder,
too.
The Nasties felt like they were...
Well, dude, this is
finishing up.
Well, dude, this is the last major show they work.
They got through Starrcade, though, didn't they?
Did they work Starrcade?
They announced them for Starrcade, didn't they?
Dude, well, let's look it up right now. I don't think they work Starrcade, dude.
You might be right. Nasty Boys.
Because who would they have worked with? The Steiners win the stupid tournament.
Oh, that's right.
They wrestled,
they
like, Great Muta and Masasaito.
Oh, they were... They might have been finishing up as soon as, like, the Omni show after this. I don't know when their last show
was. Yeah, because the Steiners wrestled Saito and Muta.
That's right. Then we go to... What was, first we got a video on, No, I'm getting ahead of myself. Shivani's with Ric Flair and Arn Anderson, and they have the contract for tonight's match where the Horseman's yacht is on the line, where if Doom were to lose, then Teddy Long would have to be the chauffeur for Ric Flair for 24 hours. Flair cuts a promo on Doom and Teddy Long, and then Anderson says that a man's greed will destroy them.
Well,
maybe the most prophetic words for WCW for the next 11 years.
Very, very true. Also, you left out the part where if Doom end up winning, that Arn and Rick don't get their rematch at Doom. And most importantly, our three homies get to enjoy the yacht. And is there some other part? Is it just the yacht? Isn't there a yacht and in the car?
The car is on the Rolls Royce.
Right. Okay. I was going to say, I thought it was a Rolls Royce, but I thought maybe I was getting ahead of myself, and that was just like the chauffeur part. Yeah. So they enjoy the Rolls Royce and the 65-foot yacht, or however long they said it was.
It was the Horseman's yacht.
It was a yacht that was large enough to contain at least four horses.
Then they go to break with a graphic plugging Sting and the Black Scorpion and the caption, "Face to Faceless."
Yeah, that's so...
This epitomized the Jim Herd era of WCW that we were living in 1990. We got a video on the history of the Black Scorpion feud. And
lots of shots of Al Perez. Lots of shots of various people being the Black Scorpion.
Yeah, the voiceover, hoping that Sting is losing his mind. And there was the magic trick at Halloween
Havoc.
Every
time I see this stuff, too, I think... Why did no one stand up to Ole? I don't mean about the gimmick. I mean, yes, about the gimmick, but I mean, like, this is Ole's idea of tough talk.
This was such a departure from, like, Ole
like,
Anderson.
Obviously,
was...
I know Ole probably didn't want to do this shit, but at the moment where Ole kind of has to take it upon himself, he's like, fuck it, he's got the voice box to his neck. That's the best he's got. The promo where he's like, he has like a ratchet or a socket wrench, and he's like banging on this piece of metal. What in the actual fuck, dude?
The woman disappeared at Halloween Havoc, and then we got a voiceover coming over a Sting Bobby Eaton match on television to set
again,
up this.
Poor Bobby Eaton. Why does it always, why is Bobby Eaton always, Bobby Eaton is the Job of pro wrestling.
Paulie Dangerously is set up here to host the Danger Zone. Sting comes out first.
Paulie Dangerously still holding his car phone with no cord in it and no car.
And Sting in a Canadian tuxedo.
Yes, Sting now has on
the double denim.
Double denim, but the denim jacket he has on almost looks waxed. And on the back, it's got a giant fucking scorpion because Sting is bad as hell.
How much do you think these were going for? Because they had to have been selling these.
I have no idea, but literally, the scorpion on the back of Sting's jacket's tough enough now that if I saw a jacket today, I'd buy it. Even with kind of like the waxy light denim finish, I'd buy that today in like a non-ironic way. It's actually hard as shit. Obviously, the light denim on light denim. A Canadian tuxedo is tough enough if you got double indigo. Double light denim, looking like a dad in 1986.
So then this music comes over top the speakers. I'm just going to describe what happens, Jordan. If you want to come in with any of your thoughts.
No, I want to hear you describe. I got the chance to describe the part that made me the happiest. I get the feeling that this is the tiger is the part that made you the happiest on this show. So I want you to describe for everyone what precisely this was like.
After the voiceover for the whole arena to hear the Black Scorpion, he appears and grabs a fan from ringside. Takes him to
really
this...
Really seems like a fan, too.
Oh, yes. He was more than willing to come along with the Black Scorpion. He is then placed into a box with his head inside of the box where the Black Scorpion proceeds to fully rotate the head in a 360-degree motion. Therefore, I assume...
This man's dead. Yeah. His neck has been broken. He's dead.
He is beheaded.
The Black Scorpion has killed a fucking man on TBS The Superstation.
The idea that we were going to have a racist team from Africa and a beheading on the same show, you would think there could have been an intersection.
Dude, not even a beheading. There was a guy with an axe. He didn't do the beheading.
And an axe.
They had a magician do the beheading. What the fuck?
So then the fan is discovered to have his body and head intact. And is placed into a cage.
He must not be human. He must be a plant.
Fuck. He's put
that's
in
the
this...
That's the best I get for that pun.
That was good.
Sean, like, in terms of... You're probably the most conversationally. Like, people, you know... I know you outside of this fake world of podcasting. Even conversationally, you are one of the toughest, hardest punners I know.
Oh, I go hard with the puns. I'm at a state of just stunning reaction to this show as I relive some of this angle as I look ahead at
all
my
right,
notes.
So we're forcing
here.
A human being into a cage. You know, you pay your ticket in Jacksonville, Florida, 1990. It's Thanksgiving. It's Tuesday. You think, oh, I'm going to go see some of the wrestling. I love Ric Flair. He's my guy. And all of a sudden, you're getting into a fucking cage.
The cage is then covered with a curtain.
You told him he could show you his black magic. I'm letting him do his stuff. Fine, let him do it.
Watch me, Sting. Give him back dangerously. Remember the
thing. Throwing him in the cage.
That's the cage. Watch now, Sting. Watch what's
now hold it, hold it. You promised him.
Let him go ahead.
Watch very closely, Sting. I'll show you powers you never knew.
What's he doing?
I possess.
Ah! Whoa, whoa, whoa! Whoa, whoa!
Sting. Imagine.
Now you made him a deal! You made him a deal! What is it? What is he? What is this?
My powers.
I'm not gonna stand for this. I'm gonna jump down there in a second. I don't care about the rules. You made him a deal!
Catch me.
Hey, get back here!
Catch me if you can,
Sting. Get back here!
Maybe at Star Games you have a chance.
What in the world? Where did he go?
See you at Star Games, Sting.
He's done it again, fans. This is a bizarre, so bizarre. We'll be back in just a moment.
The smoke goes off, and the curtain is removed, and our human fan has turned into a live tiger.
And not a regular, like, it's, as far as I know, it's easier to turn fans into tigers than humans into tigers, so this is even trickier. A regular old fan, multiple settings, easy to turn into a tiger. Real human into a tiger. Snark aside, dude, what in the actual fuck? Walk me through the process where it's like, okay, Magic is scary in the sense that I can't believe people fall for it and love it so much. It is quite frightening. But to his credit, the magician guy, Franz Harari, who did these tricks, he did them successfully. He didn't fuck any of them up. So, I mean, kudos to him. I guess he's the best scorpion, really.
Oh, true. He might have been busy on December 16th, or else he could have headlined Starcade.
Oh, God.
There's so much to take from this. I mean, in terms of just...
So okay, dude, they do the black magic thing. They decide, like, okay, the Black Scorpion's gonna have magic. I'm assuming, like, on the face, like, Oli's not into this, but he's gotta just get the voice box and be like, oh, alright, fuck, I'm the booker. I gotta do something. When they start thinking, like, okay, and obviously they have to keep postponing, because they don't have anyone to play the character. You know, they could have stopped all this magic quite quickly if they actually had... Because, dude, the thing is, we tell the story. People forget, this was not supposed to be like this. Like, no, this was supposed to be done. This was not supposed to be for Starcade. This was supposed to be something they built to, like, a clash to help Sting get over.
And they had no significant idea for Starcade. And this thing got turned into, like, a main event angle over the WCW Championship with this just... horrendous idea that found new depths to take this entire industry that you have created off of this fan base. And it's like, one of the things about professional wrestling is understanding the world that you've created around you and what fans will accept. And this was just such a far departure from even the most wacky, radical ideas that they would often criticize the WWF about. And their response in 1990 was to go tenfold of anything you were seeing in the WWF.
Yeah, and so this really is like probably the most appropriate part to talk about. I mean, we talked about how weird it was off the top, this era, this time. But most of this card sucks so much. We're talking about specifically why it sucks, not how it contextually sucks with what they're doing in terms of booking, other than Curtis Hughes. This is where it really shows up, because you see the vestiges of this very serious JCP product where, like, if a guy has a gimmick, his gimmick is basically some kind of idiosyncratic extension of his personality. It's really about, you know, the gimmicks there are about, like, what kind of man are you? Not, sure. like, what kind of character, what kind of creature are you? And you get the worst head-on collision, but worse, the people pushing it are the people that don't know the business. You know, say what you want for Vince and all and Vince's idiotic ideas and whatnot. Vince at least has the combination, even if it doesn't always gel, he has a combination of having the pro wrestling mind and having been indoctrinated into this from birth and the wacky ideas outside of it. Someone like Jim Herd, who's fucking running Pizza Hut and comes into this thing and is like, well, like more like Hulk Hogan. His ability to grasp at straws, he doesn't know what straws to reach for. He's reaching for the craziest straws. And someone like Ole Anderson, who has this serious side, is now like sort of kind of trying to arbitrate and find a way to polish up this turd. He is not prepared to deal with something like this and be the voice of the Black Scorpion and weigh in on what kind of black magic works best. This is like, again, going back to like the Meltzer Ole Anderson thing, this is just like two worlds colliding with no hope of properly just coalescing naturally. There's no sense of like organic piecing together.
Yeah, it was just there was so much that they were trying to insert into this, whether it was, you know, the Turner division that all of a sudden, hey, how can you incorporate RoboCop?
Yeah.
We've got a deal with the RoboCop franchise, and how can we insert that into professional wrestling? And not kind of understanding the genre of which you're promoting. And I think it had completely fallen off the rails of who is our audience, yeah. what we're presenting. And
but also, too, you get ideas, and one of the things is, like, this is such a bad idea time. Because this is a time of big ideas. You know what I mean? Even the best pro wrestling gimmicks, you know, even ones that people were hot for. Like, when you hear DiBiase or McMahon tell the story of their meeting in 87 to discuss the Million Dollar Man gimmick, they both make it sound like Vince had found the cure for AIDS.
Sure.
You know? They make it sound like this gimmick. It's like, really? The guy's rich.
Yeah.
Like, you think you're fucking genius? Oh, he's rich. Kick a basketball away from a kid. You think you deserve a medal? You know what I mean? So, like, but I mean, to be fair, it's an incredible gimmick. It's classic. It's timeless. It's replicated over and over again, and with good reason.
It was a great gimmick, and you also had a guy that pulled it off, which, honestly, when you're looking back at things, I mean, Ted DiBiase, I mean, he really stepped up for that role blueprint of what you had seen from him.
Sam, you know, Mushnick, you go back, you watch Wrestling at the Chase, you're watching 1974 babyface, kind of fat Ted DiBiase wrestling with no beard.
Ted DiBiase.
Yeah, are you thinking, oh, this guy has the best human laugh I've ever heard and will definitely be an immortal heel? Not a fucking chance. You're thinking, this is Mike DiBiase's son who couldn't play in the NFL. That's it. So this point in time, you get these ideas that, like, the idea is so grand that it turns into this snowball going downhill that no one can stop. Like RoboCop. Mm. Well, how did we get RoboCop in? Well, maybe we could work him on to an event. Now, there's a million ways to work RoboCop in an event, but they end up at a point where he's physically threatening the horseman, despite the fact that he's being played by an actor in a suit that can't move in the suit. Like, I don't know how deep you in weigh, because I assume you've done Capital Combat.
Yes.
So, yeah, like, you know that Peter Weller, like, or actually, it's not even Peter Weller in the suit. The guy in the suit, like, you can't move in the RoboCop suit.
Sure.
It's not a suit that's made to move. When you see the actual movies, it's shot in a way so they never actually have to show him in, like, full locomotion. The dude, like, they did not understand when they booked that the person can't put on the suit and just, like, walk or, like, run to the ring or, like, pick their hands up and grab something. You know, like, they can't do that. And yet it never got in the way of the idea of let's have RoboCop on. Much in this way, the Black Scorpion thing is, all right, well, we need to get Sting over for a little bit. Like, he's our new champ. Sting's the guy. Well, we'll do a thing. Dude, Vince did shit like this. Vince did a Saturday Night's Main Event where he put Rip Oliver in a fucking ninja outfit and had the Warrior beat the shit out of him right after Warrior Hong Kong.
Keep it to, I mean, what we were talking about earlier. I mean, sure, in history, it looks ridiculous to mock it. But, dude, The Undertaker, put that idea on paper and present it to someone.
I was going to bring this up. Dude, I mean, that's one of the best pro wrestling gimmicks ever. And crazier still, going back to...
He's dead. He's a dead guy that's going to fight.
Dude, he's not even just dead. He's dead, but likes dead things. He's dead, but he's working as an undertaker. Like, wouldn't that be the... Like, you're dead. You come back from the dead. You're undead, John. Would you think, I want to go back and be around all the circumstances which mark my demise. Like, not a fucking chance.
I mean, that was...
You die, dude, you die of a terrible, horrific disease. You're somehow reincarnated healthy, undead. Would you go work in a fucking hospice?
That was a character that never made it, unfortunately. That could have been the
AIDSer taker.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
You're welcome. Seriously, though, the Undertaker is a preposterous gimmick, and weirder, it's a preposterous gimmick that over time, you respond to it well enough that it allows you to change it. He turns into a biker. You kind of forget that he's undead. He brings back the gothic pageantry. It seems cool. Nothing ever seems off quite about it. But it's about knowing what is pro wrestling weird and what is weird.
Exactly.
Weird. And I have something to say on that in a second with relation to Doom. But the Black Scorpion thing, dude, this was supposed to seriously be like 6 to 8 weeks. They went on for 4 or 5 months because it got out of control. They just figured we'll get someone eventually. They never could. They didn't have anything else to do, so they felt trapped by it. And like this is painting yourself into a corner. Like this is craziness.
And I mean, even the payoff of what you gave at the end of it. I mean, this was just. I mean, you put Flair as the guy behind the Black Scorpion. And it's like if you had been following this. I mean, what more of a departure to Rick? Like we are to believe in this story. That Ric Flair is doing, like, hocus-pocus bullshit, turning humans into tigers and bullshit.
Also, he's in the Horseman. He's always out here. This guy who basically...
Should have been a horse, then, that it got turned into, instead of the tiger.
Should have been the sea.
Had some long-term booking.
They could have done, like, a mini-pony. Like,
or into a yacht. It could have been the giveaway.
Dude, it strikes me as odd that Flair, as flashy as, you know, the braggadocio involved, a dude who, like, even in the 80s, you know, kind of the gimmick is essentially that he's rich and on coke. How has he never done magic before? You think at some point during Mid-South, he shows up for an interview and is like, hey, motherfucker, look what I can do, and turns a handkerchief into some flowers and gives them to a woman. Woo! You know, like, he's never done magic before, but he dresses up with the Black Scorpion. Also, obviously, I get why he can't do it. He wrestles as the Black Scorpion. He's trying to beat Sting. But all of the moves that he's been so good at using to defeat people for the last, you know, 20 years, they're shit now. They're not going to work. Better use completely different moves to try to beat Sting.
And it goes to kind of what we're talking about, the Nasty Boys. And it's like, the Black Scorpion should have never resembled having any particular wrestling skill.
Nope.
It should have been...
In fact, if anything, he should have won with, like, subterfusion trickery. You know, there should have been, like, some counter-wrestling, and then he hits, like, a small package in a dastardly way and wins.
Flash paper.
Yeah, dude, well... Would you have trusted...
WCW didn't have a track record of great flash paper entrance finishes.
Well, we're a few years away from the flash paper era for WCW, but in real talk, flash paper doesn't have a great history in pro wrestling. And this era, these workers, is this the environment you want for flash paper? All we've talked about on this card, you want these assholes putting lighters on their sweaty nutsacks in their trunks, roll around for 20 minutes, bring the lighter out, hope there's no lint in it. You know what I mean? Dude, it's a lighter. You know what I mean? You take a lighter, you shove it in your pocket, tiny piece of lint gets on the top of that. That shit ain't going to light.
Could you imagine sitting down the Night Stalker and Sid, and you've got this idea. Ed Farhat is coming in, and Sabu wants to do an unannounced flash paper finish at Halloween Havoc. And we're just not going to tell anybody. And Sid, you got to pull this off.
Well, I mean, we're making fun of all this. It's terrible.
Was there anything funnier, though, than throughout this Black Scorpion run than the selling of Paulie Dangerously to just, I mean, a man that was...
No, it's the worst part of the show. Paulie Dangerously, I mean, dude, he...
For all the love Paulie Dangerously gets, I mean, this was a guy that was very much in the training wheel stage of his career.
This is the point I was going to make, is like he's just like really getting his feet wet here, developing the Paulie Dangerously character. At this point in time, it's events like this, nights like this in Jacksonville, that let you know why ECW is and was. You know, like, it seems impossible for me to imagine Paul Heyman crafting specifically the kind of pro wrestling product he went on to make without having to suffer through nights like this of overselling Sid's ribs against the Night Stalker. Because, dude, his overselling is, it's bananas, actually.
And always understanding as well what his audience would react to. And
forecasting what they would digest and what they would throw up back on them. And I think it was stuff like this that was a prime example of just a misread of your audience and pretty much slapping your longer term fan base right in the face that, man, they came up with Flair and Dusty years ago. And here we are. Ric Flair unmasked as the Black fucking Scorpion.
Fuck.
Video for the main event. perfect summarization of that segment. Video main event for the Horseman and Doom. Teddy, he went to go call Flair Big Man, but I swear to Christ, called him McMahon.
Okay, can we say something about Teddy here? Teddy is...
jacked.
He's jacked.
Would be get more jacked. Yep. But, I mean, Teddy Long, if you just have the general manager in mind or the referee in the WWF, I mean, his Doom run, holy Christ.
He shouldn't have been there, though. This is my point, and this is what I'm getting at. I think Doom, honestly, is possibly the biggest botch gimmick in the history of major pro wrestling gimmicks. And it sounds weird because Doom got over. They were title champions. Like, when you talk about Butch Reed and Ron Simmons, like, you bring it up as part of the career. Like, dude, so here's my thought. Teddy Long's fine. He's fine as a manager. He was fine with the Skyscrapers. He would have been fine with the Black Tag Team if you wanted to kind of... I mean, you get what they're going for. They put him in the Kufi hat and stuff like that. They're going for a quasi-Nation of Islam, quasi-militant power black angle. I get it. I'm there.
This was WCW 1990, which to the real world would be, I don't know, 1955?
Yes. However, this is why they blew Doom so bad. Doom should have never, ever been anything other than Doom 1 and Doom 2, led by woman. The idea, and again, I'm not advocating my personal beliefs here, you know, by all means.
No, share the gimmick idea.
Love whoever you love. But...
because I'm going to share you my idea of what Jim Herd could have come up with to
make
it worse.
Oh, Jesus. Well, I assume you're going to suggest the original Harlem Heat gimmick. But,
nope. Better.
So what you have here is, I mean, granted, Butch Reed and Ron Simmons aren't identical. It would have been better if they looked even more similar. But you're dealing to an audience that is historically fairly racist part of the world.
What are you talking about, Jordan?
What are you talking about? I know. The way
we're going to have Harlem Heat come out in chains.
The way to do this gimmick is to have not just any woman, literally a woman named Woman. The stand-in for any woman. Literally, her name's Woman. She is any white woman. She is going to manage not two black guys, not Black Guy 1, Black Guy 2. We're literally going to name them the thing that all you racist pieces of shit envision this as. Doom 1, Doom 2. The powerful black men, the Mandingos, have come for all your women. They are faceless. They are nameless. They are two black dudes in black tape and black boots and black pants and ski masks. They are going to beat all of the white faces and fuck all the white women, and you're all terrified.
Wow, Jordan Breen, the WCW Booking Committee of 1990, I don't know how they would have responded to
you. I know, obviously.
However, I mean...
I'm being hyperbolic and heinous here, but is this not how this should work? Isn't that... Dude, the original...
Listen, with Harlem Heat and Sherry, I mean, that's what they wanted to project.
Yeah.
I mean, that wasn't some coincidence that Sherry managed Harlem Heat to play off of that and play off this black fear that they perceived in their audience.
But the thing is, it makes it even better with these folks. Even the kinds of bodies that Ron Simmons and Butch Reed have, just kind of like that classic smooth steroid bloat, you know, where they just look like giant, like they just look imposing. It's not that they look strong, like they just look massive. And like the ski masks, perfect. Not even masks, fucking ski masks. Because we're racist and we all know you think that they're gonna rob your house too. And dude, even Woman, it's again, Sherry's great. Love Sherry. But Sherry's demeanor, like Sherry's demeanor almost helps Harlem Heat in the sense that, like, you know, it's kind of like a weird kind of like Sugar Mama Jungle Fever thing, but she's kind of like the power figure. Woman's kind of like the power figure. Like, she led Doom around, but like even then she's kind of like minxier and more silent. She's like Nancy Sullivan as Woman is like less of a woman and less of a person. She's kind of like inhuman and strange. There's like a weird otherness to her. Mm. She just kind of exists. She exists on like a sexual malicious plane, and that's it. The idea of having her with, like, her walking around in a bow tie and teased hair, leading around Doom 1 and Doom 2 forever, not Ron Simmons, not Butch Reed, just Doom 1, Doom 2. Awesome. And then you don't even need the same guys. You just need black guys that look the same. You could have the Doom gimmick forever.
Okay.
They fucked it up.
Well, your tag team, I'm sure, would incite many an angry letter to one CNN center. My thought of Jim Herd, and I can't believe he didn't think of this. I mean, for a tag team called Doom, the idea that, you know, and this is a guy who came up with the Hunchbacks and computer programs to break down opponents. We have Ron Simmons and Butch Reed. They wrestle with GoPros on, so the camera angle is first person, and you just see them attacking in the style of Doom. How did this idea, had it been presented in 1990, I feel 90% they would have gone with.
God, so basically,
you see Doom, all their offense.
Doom with lapel cams, basically.
On the forehead.
Yeah, obviously.
And then maybe an axe you take from Night Stalker and you can use it.
Here's the reason that
Chainsaw finish.
Here's the reason I can't critique that. Apart from saying it's stupid. They did that referee cam.
The referee cam.
It's not on this card, but like this time in
without like a hockey helmet where Nick Patrick had the camera on his fucking helmet. And if you think that was ridiculous in 1990, TNA brought this back years later. Years and years later. That happened with over the past 5 years. They tried to introduce a camera on one of the participants.
I'm touching. I'm selling like Sid.
He's trying to shake the smoke out of his ears.
It's between my eyes, and it stings, it burns, and itches.
Oh, Doom and the Horsemen are out, and we got to do a coin toss.
Why did they not do this at the beginning of the show? The way they should have done this is like either at the beginning of the show or in the middle of the show, have the coin toss so we know what the match is going to be. Obviously, we know it's going to be Flair, but if you're going to say there's going to be a coin toss to pick one of Doom and one of, which is fine. You know, I like the idea, but do it in a way that sets up, because it's like, it's cheap. It's like, oh, what's the match going to be? And it's like, coin flip. Oh, here's your match. I want some time to reflect, stew on this, you know?
Tune in. You might see Ric Flair wrestle tonight.
Dude, that is another part of it. Knowing that you're going with Flair, don't you want anyone watching this fucking thing to know beyond a shadow of a doubt, our main event tonight, Ric fucking Flair's wrestling, people, stick around.
It's what, I mean, WWE, when they would run the Taboo Tuesday Cyber Sunday cards, I mean, that's what they were selling you. You might see this guy in the main event, and you might see him against this guy. And it's like people didn't respond to might see. Anyway, it was a free show. Flair and Butch Reed would headline the card. This would be in the upper tier of Butch Reed matches of his career. Maybe the best.
Dude, I was going to say this. I mean, if I've seen a better Butch Reed match than this, it's in Mid-South in 83 or 84 with Flair. And obviously, I think we can safely assume that's why they were chosen. Simmons is still more green, and even though there's no question who historically, or even at this point, who the better worker was, it's fucking Ron Simmons, Reed's got the history with Flair, so that's obviously why they were chosen.
Flair was already 41 at this time. Did you notice this lump on his back?
Yes, I did. I was about to say, do you think Flair had a staph infection?
Well, I mean... From the kind of carrying he was doing, his back was probably a mess at this particular time. But a very noticeable, lump on his middle of his back. Just Flair's job was a ping pong ball in this match.
However, the thing I like about it is that Flair, even at his heely selling best, knows how and when to get offense in, so you never quite feel like, you know, like, he never does the honky-tonk man cower, where he's just such a pussy that it's like, it's this interminable Vince-type cartoon.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, dude, they chop each other at the beginning, and like, Butch Reed obviously gets better. Dude, they're fucking wailing on each other.
Dude, the overhand chops by Butch Reed.
Butch Reed's chops in this matchup, holy shit. If you think fucking chops are fucking indie boys doing fucking, you know, laying on each other in the corner, and then dudes trying to do kibashi, you want to see a different spin on how to hurt a man with a chop? Come watch Butch Reed throw overhand volleyball spikes at fucking Ric Flair. Holy shit. Dude, this looks so... Also, think about the way your hand is contacting versus... Like, when you get chopped like that, you know, it stings, but like the fingers are hitting like you're stinging the skin. It's like when you get cracked with a towel. Dude, he is palm smashing him. This fucking... Like, you're given the chance to bruise someone. Like, he's hitting him in like the clavicle and sternum and cracking him.
He was just going full overhand slap right to the chest of Flair. I mean, overhand chops typically, they suck because most people
hit them with their fingers.
Exactly. And they look like shit even though they do sting. These ones, they look great and hurt like a motherfucker.
That's because this goes back to what we're talking about with Sid. You know, could Sid chop like that? More importantly, if this was Sid and Butch Reed, Do you think Butch Reed would be in there working with Sid like that?
It would have punctured a lung.
Well, would have punctured, seriously, probably would have legit hurt Sid, no kayfabe, as a dude got hurt all the fucking time. And also probably would have made Sid fucking cry and grab a squeege in the back. What? So when I see this, I just think, again, this is what I'm talking about. These are two guys. Look, they're different guys. One's white, one's black. They're both kind of heel face. The dynamic here is actually kind of cool where, you know, Flair is more face than ever, but he's still working the heel offense. But Reed is still actually getting over doing face offense. It's a cool dynamic that like kind of lets the crowd choose their own adventure however they want. But what really stands out to me here, other than how good it is simply because they have the experience and Flair's the best, is they're beating the shit out of each other. Flair has clearly identified Butch Reed, just like, dude, beat the shit out of me. And when Flair gets his chances to hit Butch Reed, he lays into Butch Reed. There's a spot where Flair beats him into the ring to, coward run in the ring, hit him. He runs and kicks Butch Reed in the ribs. It looks preposterously hard.
There was this awesome spot here where Reed applies the figure four.
How good is Reed's figure four? John, how often do we see guys steal moves? This is our third and final one of the night. Think about every Scorpion Deathlock you've seen from someone not named Bret Hart. Think how bad Shawn's is, other than Owen, too. Think how bad Davey Boy's is, or was, RIP.
Dwayne Johnson's.
I was building up to the fucking worst of the worst, Dwayne The Rock Johnson's. Butch Reed, and dude, the figure four, they literally do this spot the next Clash of Champions. Flair wrestles Rick Steiner next Clash of Champions. Rick Steiner puts him in a figure four. So like they go back to the spot throughout. They did it before this. They went through this throughout Flair's career. But for a big, bricked up, immobile dude who seems like a dead cert to blow a move like this, Butch Reed's figure four goes on fast, looks good.
And Flair sold it tremendously. It was a great spot. Nick Patrick, after Flair reaches the ropes, finally has to pull Reed by the hair to break the hold as he won't let go of it. Flair gets busted above the right eye from one shot that just connected above his eyebrow.
Butch Reed does a head scissors, and they do the inverted bridge up to a backslide combo.
These two had this 15-minute match down pretty pat. They did a near fall with Teddy Long putting Reed's foot onto the bottom rope, mm-hmm. and then Arn pulls Patrick to the floor during another cover attempt before that became a staple near fall spot. Reed then comes off the top like an airplane crashing into Ric Flair with a shoulder block.
Reed actually throws a drop kick in this, and it's not great, but like someone told me, like, Butch Reed's just about to throw a spontaneous drop kick. I'd be like,
Flair starts like convalescing as if he's lost feeling in his legs. The ref is still on the floor with Arn and Teddy Long as Flair comes back body drops Reed over the top rope and lands on Patrick and Long, and then Simmons is in, clotheslines Flair.
For a convoluted ending, for a classic convoluted overbook ending like this, they nail it. And in this finish, you see why so much of this card is so bad. And specifically, why Sid and the Night Stalker so bad? Timing. The timing from Arn pulling him out to Teddy getting in the fight with Nick Patrick to like everything, like no one has to pretend like they don't see anything. No one has to stand there like an idiot for 10 seconds and wait for something to happen. Like there's three or four mini stupid swerves at the end, but everyone is there on point.
You could do a slow motion replay for any of this.
Exactly.
And it finishes up with a Arn coming in with a chair shot to Reed as Simmons had been celebrating the fact
Simmons
he had closed
lays Flair out to finish it. He lays him out. He puts Reed on top of Flair. He rolls out of the ring. Again, timing. Right as he rolls out of the ring on the far side and it puts his hands up to the crowd to celebrate, Arn rolls into the ring on the other side, fast as fuck, hits Reed with the chair, throws Flair on top and rolls out. On top of that, Nick Patrick gets right back in, right, like in a perfect amount of time to feasibly miss Arn hitting him with the chair, but still count quick enough that Reed doesn't have to act like he has no idea what's happening in the ring. There is so much stupid shit happening with this finish, and somehow Arn Anderson's the glue guy, man. Arn holds this thing together with the timing and the chair shot and makes this look like, dude, when Ron Simmons turns around and realizes that Flair's won is like legit surprised, you don't even feel like it's pro wrestling. Like, dude, you fucking idiot. You stood there for 30 seconds. It's so bang, bang, bang that you feel like this could have actually happened.
Well, 14 minutes, 13 seconds where Flair gets the win. So not only do they get the rematch with Doom at Starrcade, but now Teddy Long has to be their chauffeur for 24 hours. And then they go off with, as I mentioned, Ross plugging Starrcade as the next great wrestling pay-per-view coming up. Don't buy Survivor Series on Thursday night.
Fuck Hogan. Fuck Kane the Undertaker. Fuck this Tuesday in Texas and all the stuff that's coming up. It's no good. Starrcade 90, the Black Scorpion, Black Magic, and the Pat O'Connor Tag Team Tournament's what you want.
And maybe an animal or two.
Yeah, well, I mean, if there's no tigers there, I mean, maybe a horse this time. Flair, show us. Turn someone into a Shetland pony, Flair.
Well, they would do at Super Brawl the next year. They did have bears coming down to the ring, I believe, with Big Josh. So they had tigers, they had bears. I'm trying to think if they ever did a lion just for the full trinity.
Big Josh, people wonder why Matt Bourne went crazy.
That wraps up a very entertaining look at Clash of the Champions 13. I don't think we could do a better infomercial for this particular
event. Get on the network
event.
And watch it, kids.
I mean, for only $12 in Canada, you could do a lot worse with your money than catching Clash of the Champions. Jordan, this was awesome. I definitely want to do this again at some point. Should you be able to stomach another early 90s WCW show, or you want to go off the grid somewhere else? Always happy to have you on the program.
My diet consists largely of obscure shit. You know what I mean? This is the kind of garbage I love. As much as, you know, it's nice to sit down, you watch, like, you know, WrestleMania, you know, or sit down and watch like a classic Starrcade or whatever. I want to watch shitty Clash of the Champions. I want to watch Jack Victory wrestle three times in one night under different masks because a bunch of guys no-showed.
Yeah. I enjoy this period because, you know, I didn't get WCW at this point in time. So, I mean, what I've seen from like a 1990 WCW period, it's pretty limited. So I like going back, and a lot of this stuff, you've heard about a lot of this shit. But
and Clash
seeing
of the Champions
it,
events are the perfect. It really is a clash. You know what I mean? Because Clash events, they're smaller and shittier, so you get kind of some of these ridiculous squash-type settings.
Sure.
But you get it mixed in with some legitimate great shit. There's some Clashes that are amazing. And yet, at the same time, especially in this era, you have the clash between the old and the new, the good and the bad, the sensible and the fucking insane. Everything about this is like this weird kind of duality, and Clash of the Champions cards seem to represent it the best.
You can catch Jordan Breen all the time over at SureDog.com, a staple on the Cheap Seats program on SiriusXM, a frequent member, pretty much a staple on the SureDog roundtables ahead of every single MMA card and anything else, Jordan, to let our listeners into the world of Jordan Breen. I mean, you do tweet about professional wrestling from time to time. You kind of, you know, you'll share your two cents.
If you're the kind of person that's down for a whole lot of mixed martial arts tweet and then maybe, you know, one random morning at 4 a.m., a tweet along the lines of "One Man Gang was real underrated," I'm your guy.
That's your guy. Give him some feedback on his Doom idea.
I mean, I know, obviously, I probably explained it in the worst way possible. Like, I made it sound like a crazy minstrel show and kind of revealed myself to be this horrific racist. But, again, I'm not a bad guy. I'm not saying I'm a horrific racist. All I'm saying is, everyone who would have gone to a house show of WCW in 1990 is a horrific racist. So I'm really not a bad guy.
First person shooter.
They
really lost out.
Yeah, FPS, man. FPS was the way of the future. 1990 first person shooter tag teams would have been huge.
That will wrap up today's show. Next week on the program, Wei Ting is back, but I will not be. It will be Wei and Dan the Mouth Lavransky next week because the G1 is kicking off next week, and it's going to be a very busy time period. But you can catch all of our shows up here at liveaudiowrestling.com. Subscribe on iTunes, and we will be back later this week with our whole host of shows. Once again, thank you very much, Mr. Breen.
Thanks, dude.
Hey, I'll tie one hand behind my back, and we'll do it all over again. What happened?
All right, the fabulous free.
Hey, Freebirds, you're not so bad, are you now? You gutless cowards, next time we get our hands on you, you're butt-sized because we got 7'7", 450 pounds of Elegante, and he's going to be on you like a duck on a June bug.